power of our diplomacy.
Yeah, apparently that's a really big deal.
The strength of our diplomacy.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
It does sound kind of fun.
One. Deadline.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Diplomacy Cast. Diplomacy Cast is a podcast about the board game Diplomacy. My name is Eric Mead. His name
is Nathan Barnes.
He's just going to take over the show all by himself. I don't even get to talk anymore. It's cool. How you doing, Nathan?
I'm really excited. I mean, we're in the midst of pre-house party mode, and there's going to be at least 100 unicorns here.
Yeah, that may be true. Thanks for coming to our party, everybody. If you hear it through the microphone, well, it's like you're here.
It's amazing. I'm so glad you could make it.
In this episode, we have a table talk segment like we always do. This table talk segment, we're just going to talk about some miscellaneous, generic, didn't fit anywhere else slang that you're going to hear around the tournament scene that we thought we ought to define. And in our power play segment, we're going to talk about Germany.
It's a wonderful country, Germany. Lots of beer.
Yeah, it's all right, I guess. As countries go.
I mean, as to visit, not to play.
Also, we have a very special guest.
We do have a very special guest. He's one of my favorite people.
Yeah. A longtime tournament stalwart organizer.
A guy that I have spent a ridiculous amount of time with on a plane, actually.
Me too. It's weird. flew back with him from the last...
I know. Yeah. Oh my god, I went to Germany with him.
Woo! He's like an airplane stalker. His name is Matt Shields.
And he's amazing.
If you have any questions, any feedback, please email us at press@diplomacycast.com and be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes.
Woohoo!
So, we have a new website.
We do have a... Thank God.
Oh, my gosh. It's so cool. Peter Backman, you are our hero. He has designed this for us, despite not being a Diplomacy player himself and just being an all-around great guy.
I think he's just a super fan, is what he is.
He's our number one super fan. Yeah.
And it's really nice that he took the time to put it together. And
and now I can release his children from my basement.
Which is nice. I mean, I would say you didn't have to put a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah, no, but he did it. And it's amazing. And I hope you're all enjoying it. But with that website comes the interactive part of this show that we've been looking so forward to.
Just the opportunity for you guys, everybody out there, to send us hate mail.
Which we're expecting in droves.
I'm hoping for a lot of that. But if you have any suggestions, any directions we want to go, or you want to hear, or there you have a question, please definitely let us know, because sooner or later you're going to get tired of us defining terms for you.
Yeah, and we're going to create a whole new segment just for your guys' emails, to be named later, not sure yet, but...
it'll be pithy.
It may even be in this episode, depending on how fast it all pours in. And in addition to that, you may have noticed on the front page, there's a spot where you can plug your diplomacy stuff. So send that on out to us. You got a tournament, you got a house game, you got anything.
Right. Let us help you put it together. We know some people, and it'll be good for you.
You got some online stuff that you do that you want people to be a part of? We're happy to plug that, too. So press@diplomacycast.com.
Do it.
Okay.
Send it.
Time for table talk.
Woohoo! Now it's time for, what's the name of this section?
We call it Table Talk.
Yes, we do. It's about talking.
At the table.
Yeah!
Well, it'll have to do. In a pinch.
But we're going to talk about a couple of terms that, once again, we were reflecting on. We listened to some of the old episodes, and we're like, oh, you know what? We've used some terms, and let's talk about them. Let's make sure everybody knows.
Yep. We're going to start with one that you might see featured on our nice new website.
A shiny website.
The About Us section. Cutthroats and Care Bears.
Which, I don't know about you, Eric, but I feel like this is a newer thing in the last 10 years. We didn't talk about it, and then suddenly everyone was like, oh, we're going to call this thing, we're going to have shorthand themes for it.
I feel like it's already retro. Like, I feel like it was new for a while, and it's already out of style.
That's true. I guess that's true. But I guess for us it is, but for a lot of people it's brand new. It's like someone the first time they heard the word tubular.
Yeah. Yeah. And people still... Whoa.
Yeah. You ready for that?
That's not on the list, man. I'm not defining tubular.
Yes. Cutthroats and Care Bears, though. What's a cutthroat?
Well, so it's to differentiate two different styles of play on the diplomacy board, and it's not meant to be all inclusive or anything, but it's just something that gets bandied about for two different types of players. A cutthroat is a guy who's really only in it for themselves. An alliance is only useful to him for as long as it's useful to him, and the fact that you did him a favor last turn is completely irrelevant to him. He's going to do what's best for him on the next turn.
And to be clear, these are mostly terms we throw at people when they do things we don't like.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
I mean, these aren't actual. It's sort of like, wow, you were such a Nazi there. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like, it's just a horrible thing. You like, so don't try and think it's like a school, like a school, like, oh, you're a Republican, or you're like, I have a consistent political theory. This is really just, you know, shit talk.
Straight down the ticket, Care Bear.
Vote it.
Yeah. No. So it's, and then the opposite of it again is a Care Bear. Obviously.
Right. Which what's interesting about this, and you already have already figured out what a Care Bear is, but it's someone that, you know, they stick to their alliance no matter what. They tend to, I think they call it, like, they don't take off the gloves. They have a soft hand. They're just, they're not people that are out to really be vindictive. So the interesting thing about this is it tends to, at least there's a tendency to fall on like a coastal sort of divide.
That was the classic way anyway.
Right. So West Coast people tend to be branded as Care Bears.
And East Coast cutthroat. I've actually lived on both coasts and played in both places, and it's kind of true.
It is kind of true.
I mean, and it's not to say that you never get stabbed on the West Coast, you always get stabbed on the East Coast. You can have good alliances one place.
Sure.
But there's definitely a slightly different approach, and specifically, like, classically, the West Coast guys would love to do these, like, dirty game-long alliances where it didn't matter if it was good or bad, you were just going to stick together the entire way and just see how far and irrationally you could take the alliance. We've all done that. I mean, people on the East Coast do it too from time to time. It's just, I don't know, it's a different style.
And I don't want to, we could have an entire episode talking about this, so I don't want to go too far, but actually, now that I think about it, we should have a whole episode about this, and we should have multiple guests just to talk about what is it and why, because frankly it's super interesting, and it's not right now, not the time. We should talk about what a Janissary is.
All right, Janissary. That's one that I actually said, or one of us actually said a couple episodes ago, and we were like, oh, okay, we'll define that in the next table talk, and then promptly forgot about it. Janissary is just a term for somebody who you've basically already defeated, but they've still got a piece or two or three on the board, and they've decided that for whatever reason, like, they don't blame you as bad as they blame somebody else on the board, and what would be fun for them is just to continue to play and do whatever it is that you ask them to do with those remaining pieces.
So when you have someone just by the throat, and you don't go in for the kill, you decide, you know what, I can probably use this person. And they happen to be somebody that's willing to say, you know what, you're right, I really don't like Italy. Classically, one of the reasons this came up is because we were talking about Turkey. Turkey tends to be the classic Janissary for a variety of reasons, but it can happen anywhere on the board. You just have somebody and they're your dog and they sick.
Yeah, and the reason that you might ever do that, be a Janissary, is because, A, maybe you're madder at somebody than the person who actually did most, like, owns most of your home centers. Maybe you blame somebody else for that, and you just want to get back at them.
Or you just want to keep playing.
I'm definitely
Janissary to try and keep in the game, you know?
Yeah, sometimes, that's the thing, is sometimes it happens. Instead of just giving up, you go, you pretend to be a good dog for a little while, and then at the moment that your master isn't paying enough attention to you and has just assumed that you're going to write whatever order he tells you to, that's when you go grab a couple of your centers back and you get back in the game.
Bite that hand that feeds you, you know?
Sure. Or else, you know, maybe try and create a bunch of chaos on the board while being a Janissary in hopes that someone will get too big and everyone else will panic and go, oh God, we can't cut this guy out anymore.
And the final way is honestly, there's a lot of tournament structures in which it makes sense to try and stay in the game as long as possible and get part of a draw. So it could be some other. Anyway, there does tend to be a particular portion, a point in the game in which, you know, you're not viable, and you're toadying.
Yeah, and it's more fun to be a Janissary if you have fleets than armies in most cases.
I think you know what? You're sidetracking.
Just because you get to talk like a pirate.
It is fun to talk like a pirate.
Popped. Just when you hear us say units popped,
and we'll say it a lot without thinking.
So. That just means for whatever reason, retreated off the board. It either means they didn't have a valid retreat and therefore they have to come off the board, or a lot of times we'll talk about popping on purpose, where you have a fleet and you'd rather have an army, or you have a piece in one space and you'd rather remove it from the board and build it back home.
There's a diplomatic reason for doing it. It's just the only way you can ever take a piece off the board is manufacturing or being forced into a position in which you have no retreats.
Yeah.
And in that case, you are popped.
Yep. Well, you can always voluntarily retreat off the board, and that's popping it too. Did I say? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're totally right. I misspoke.
That's all right. A couple that go back to sort of postal and online play here. NMR.
Yeah. I don't think people say it a lot anymore.
Yeah, it just stands for no moves received. It was sort of lingo way back when in those days, which we'll, I'm sure, talk about someday in an episode.
But it is a shorthand way to say someone just boned it and didn't turn in any orders before the time.
Yeah, and it can be because they got mad and went home. It can be because they didn't notice the clock. Whatever. NMR is NMR. It means all your pieces hold because you didn't put any orders in.
Right.
A gunboat is kind of an interesting one because people actually use it wrong. So I'll
you know what? Now that I think about it, you're totally right. They do use it wrong all the time.
I'll say the actual meaning of it and then what we actually say. So, or what we actually use it for. I mean, gunboat is, it used to mean just an anonymous game where you didn't know who the other players were, which obviously is something you could only do in postal or online play. But it is, so it was a slightly different style because you never could judge the personalities of the people except in the game.
That's a reference to gunboat diplomacy, which is just like, which is something from the late 19th and early 20th century, which is, you're just going to send your boats in and intimidate people without actually negotiating.
Get a little something extra here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want?
No. I'm sorry. That was good. A little history lesson. I enjoyed it.
That's a little bit of poetry just for you.
Online, there were gunboat games. Most of the gunboat games were also no press games. And no press meant no talking. Not only did you not know who the people were, you weren't even allowed to communicate with them.
Right. And you would just submit moves and things would go.
Yeah.
And you would just hope for the best.
There's a lot of people who love it online and think it helps them. I cannot for the life of me play a no press
game.
Well,
I mean, it's
like
because great way if for all of you out there that are just starting out in diplomacy and you feel intimidated by just the mechanics of it, go out and find a gunboat game in which you can just practice moving the pieces around.
There you see that Nathan actually did that thing, used the terms interchangeably, even though they're not interchangeable, but we usually say gunboat when we mean no press. And a lot of times you'll hear it, there's a game at a tournament that's kind of slogged down to the point where none of the alliances are changing and nothing, you know, there's nobody who's talking anybody into or out of anything. And it's just this tactical slog for some coalition to try and gain ground over another coalition, and we'll say, oh yeah, this is just a gunboat game now, like there's no point even. Yeah,
but there you can definitely get on those games where it doesn't matter whether or not there's press or not, or it doesn't matter whether or not it's anonymous or not. Like there are games you can get on in which really it's all just about the tactics from 1901.
Yeah,
and that's a really great way to just sort of try your hand at things without really worrying too much about the rest of it.
Yep. Drop dead just means when you have to means.
Well, it's a style.
Yeah. In tournaments. Well, first of all, it could mean, hey, Nathan, drop dead. like what you say after the orders are read on a board that you're playing with.
I usually go with die in a fire.
Yeah, yeah. I hate you so much is one.
Yeah, no. No, it's there's as many of you know, as you've read the rules, there's timing involved in diplomacy. And when the time's up, your order's supposed to go in. When you're in a tournament setting, sometimes we're a little stricter about it. And we come up with ways of saying, you don't get time to write your orders. You're just done when the timer's up. And the word for that, Eric,
is drop dead.
Is drop dead.
So in other words, in a drop dead style tournament, you'll get 15 minutes or something, you know, some amount of minutes, including order writing. So they'll say 15 drop dead means all your negotiation and your order writing has to happen before the buzzer.
Right. So that little order writing time that's in the rules, that 3 minutes or 2 minutes, whatever it is, depending on how you play and what rule set you have.
Yeah.
that's incorporated into the time. So you get none. It makes the game go faster. It makes it so that people don't, you know, bogart things and take up 15 minutes writing their orders because they have a million units.
Yep, because some people do. And I saved the best for last. Nathan's favorite, the Flying Dutchman.
Why do you say it's my... Are you implying something when you say it's my favorite?
No. Well, everybody loves a Flying Dutchman. Who doesn't love a Flying Dutchman?
I thought you were accusing me of something.
The Flying Dutchman, it's just when you slip a little extra piece on the board there. Now,
that's not fair. That's not fair. Like, sometimes it's an accident.
That's true.
And at least it's always an accident.
Of course, even the times that it's not. And we here at Diplomacy Cast do not advocate the use of the Flying Dutchman, but...
We are entirely against the purposeful Flying Dutchman.
Yes. If an extra piece that you did not have the supply center to support happened to find its way on the board, and someone said, hey, that's a Flying Dutchman, at least you'd know before everyone looked extremely sternly at you and you had to take it back off.
It's often joked about, and you'll just hear it thrown around because it's... While we don't advocate it, it's hilarious.
It is a little hilarious.
It's a little really funny. If someone just really has the cojones to say, I'm just going to put this extra army on there. And usually it comes about when it's a build phase and people are like, they just set down their piece. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yep, there's my...
I got to build.
I'm going to write the order for it. And, you know, that's one of the reasons if you're out there playing a tournament game or you're playing face-to-face, you really always need to be paying attention to what your fellow players are doing.
You never know. There's not really... Well, I don't even know. There's not really a punishment for it. You have to take it back off.
Yeah, well, yes, it you have to take it back off. Obviously. It depends on the tournament, obviously. I mean, you're not going to get, like, booted out of the game, but which unit gets pulled is... That could really make a difference.
And you will get shamed by your peers, which...
And, well, mocked mercilessly.
Yeah.
That'll come up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which should be a deterrent. I don't know if it is.
It depends on how hilarious it is.
We're done.
You know what? That's table talk. Those are all the terms you're going to need when you're out there and people are trying to screw you.
That's a bold statement.
That's it. We're done.
That's all you needed.
Until one of you out there writes us and says, hey, I need to know about something.
Press at diplomacycast.com. We'll be back after this. Welcome to Power Plays.
This is the part... This is my favorite part.
Yeah, well, it's probably everyone else's favorite part, too.
Yeah, really, because we're actually talking about some substance.
Yeah,
instead. Yeah, this is the good stuff, people. This is the stuff, take notes.
Here we go.
Germany.
Yeah, Germany. Not Nathan's favorite country.
Really, really at the bottom of my list.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll play anything, and like, if you want to get down to it, it's like, oh, I don't have a favorite country, but... I do have a country I don't particularly like drawing.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I mean, I'm sort of at a point now where my favorite country is the one that it's been longest since I've played, because I'm like, ooh, how does that go? But I understand. Germany can be kind of a drag at times. Although, I don't know. I feel like maybe I have sort of happier memories of good Germanies.
Yeah. You must have. Well, maybe... Not, no pun intended, luck of the draw, but I just have gotten maybe kicked in the balls a few more times.
With the
old German.
What is it you don't like about playing Germany?
Well, that's a really good question, because I don't think I've ever tried to articulate it before.
Well, no time like the present.
Yeah, woo! I really think that it has a very short opening period, and you have like 2 years, and... If you don't do that right, and you misstep, you're right in the center, and your centers are such that it's easy to get squeezed.
Yeah.
And I feel like I often find myself, you know, Berlin sports Munich, Kiel sports Munich, and I have one fleet in like Baltic or worse, Sweden that can do nothing.
Absolutely.
Like, I feel like I'm there a lot.
Absolutely. The offense can turn into defense. And once you're playing defense,
it's really hard to get out of the defense with Germany.
It's never going to get any better. You get surrounded, you get stuffed in your home centers for sure.
Right, and the same with Austria, but I think it's one of the weaknesses of those two very, very central powers that you just, once you're there, it's really hard to fight your way out.
Well, I think the difference with Austria, not to get too far down that thing, but I think the difference with Austria is that Austria gets popped like an overripe fruit at the point where everybody's decided to kill them. Germany has to hang on and fight for dear life for a while, and then eventually...
Right, and I think there's outs with Austria. There's a lot of places you can go.
Exactly.
You're right up against the sea as Germany. So if you've plopped down a bunch of armies, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's why I think I don't like it so much. I'm not that I've had great Germanys. I'm not, you know, I've done well. It's just, I feel like more often than not, I'm in a place that it seems a little bit redundant and not as much fun.
I understand for sure. Yeah, no, I definitely see that. I will speak to the strength of it a little bit, I think, because I think that Germany sort of feels like Germany, the real Germany, must have felt in actual 1900. If it gets going, it can just be this metal factory of just cranking out just this giant war machine where it just grows and grows and grows, and there's so little that anyone can do about it unless.
Well, that's the other side of the coin for being in the center.
Yeah.
Right. So if you can get past that, and you know, Austria can be similar. Mm-hmm. It's just you're in a really great spot to just churn stuff out.
Yeah.
So
it if it can grow and hang on to what it gets, it becomes really hard to deal with because of the geographic location of it. It's close to things. You know, it's cranking out units right on the stalemate line, and it can get really just. It can just get going.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with that. It's getting going that I have a problem with.
Absolutely.
If I could get to that spot, if I knew where if I had a map of the city and I knew right where that was, that sweet spot, yeah, I think I'd enjoy Germany a little bit more. It's a little elusive.
Yeah, it is.
In my
it is
experience.
Well,
but it's. I don't know how other people feel about it. I think Germany is one of those places that. I often hear people in my position and your position, they either really like it or they really don't. It's a hot, cold country.
I think one of the things is I think it lends itself to a conservative style of play, which is one thing. There's like not a bunch.
Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah. And probably neither of us really likes to play that way. And so we should have a third person who maybe does, but there's not a lot of crazy gambits with Germany. There's not a lot of like, I'm just going to throw it all in this and it's either going to work and it's going to be glorious or I'm going to go down in flames.
You know what there is? You can't faint very well with Germany. There's really not a lot of like, pretend time, and there's not a lot, like, you really can't do things where it looks like you're doing something else and you're actually setting up for what you really want to do, where a lot of other countries you can do that
exactly.
So I think one of the things that you have to deal with Germany is you are kind of at the spear points of two countries that have nobody at their back. You've got England and France
right
next to you,
right?
And honestly, and we've talked about this before, an EF can be really lovely.
A nice alliance, yeah.
It can really go well.
And I think that's the first thing that I'm usually thinking when I'm Germany is, oh, man, how do I talk them out of an EF?
Right.
Because I think especially when it's just sort of newer players, they go, oh, England, France, that's like history. That seems natural. Why don't I just do that? And Germany, here's this target, and he's surrounded. And
he usually loses in World Wars, so let's go get that guy.
Exactly. You're definitely, your first job, obviously, is to get at least one of those guys on your side.
Yeah. You need to, much like when we talked about with the RT, you really need to make sure those guys aren't spending too much time by themselves.
Definitely. So, I want to start with England because I'm a little embarrassed, having listened back to the England episode, how incredibly little we talked about the England-Germany alliance in that one. Got a little sidetracked.
It might be because I suck at Germany.
Yeah, that could be. That could be. Nathan was like, yeah, boring. Anyway,
yeah, let's move on. That's a non-starter. Yeah.
England, Italy, there's where it's at.
That's where it's at.
So we want to give the England-German relationship like a real good look in this episode.
I do think it can work.
Oh, it absolutely can work. I mean, I know that for a while up here in the Northwest, it seemed to be the default.
Because the great thing about it is that France is such a, you know, statistical powerhouse. Like, mm-hmm. if you just run the numbers, if you had AIs just run simulations.
Not Austria, Italy's artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. Sorry. Thank you. if you had bots run games just unto themselves ad infinitum, like, you're going to find France come out a lot on top. A lot. Yeah.
I think that's
just true. Because there's a lot of innate advantages of it.
Yeah.
To counter that, I think you're right. There's been a lot of tournament play that's been, you know, EG. Mm-hmm. Let's just get this in the bud right now.
We have to find a way to deal with France early. At least contain him, you know, if not, just take him out. So early on dealing with England, the interesting thing I think about your pre-01 negotiations with England mm-hmm. are the fact that they don't actually, like, they can be best buddies or worst enemies, and it's not really going to change their opening moves that much. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you're right.
Germany can't really move. I mean, there's a couple things you can do that are slightly more aggressive.
That fleet is going to border the North Sea.
The fleet's going to border the North Sea no matter how Germany opens. And England...
Well, opens intelligently, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's gambits that England can do that threaten you.
Right.
But there's not a ton that where he can just go right into you. I mean, like, if you look at France and Germany, to skip ahead for just a second, they at least have a border space. They have Burgundy, and they can opt to not go there if they want to be friends,
sure.
or go there if they want to be enemies. Whereas England and Germany don't really have a space like that mm-hmm. at pre-01. And so when you're dealing with England pre-01, I think you end up kind of just talking principle. More than anything else. So there's not a ton of spaces that you're going to be talking about, well, what are you going to do here? What are you going to do there? Now, obviously, you'd love it if you could convince him to go to the English Channel.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, I mean, and then hopefully, if you got the right person,
yeah.
you can do that. But there's no way, no good England is going to leave the North Sea open, and no good Germany is not going to be on one of the centers that borders the North Sea.
Either Holland or Denmark, he means.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Because you can open to one or the other of those. You can just have them. That's one of the main right. tactical advantages of Germany is they're just right next to Holland and Denmark. And
knock, knock.
If you don't get one or the other, then you've done something terribly wrong.
Terribly wrong.
By the way, we'll get, I guess, maybe cover this a little more
yeah,
later.
Yeah, we'll cover that later.
You'll generally get both. You should expect, but no one else on the board is going to disagree with you that you have the right to both of those centers
yeah.
if you can manage to take them yourself. Mm-hmm. So though sometimes Germany's do only build one, you should be thinking about building at least two.
Yeah. And I agree. That's another strength of Germany is like you end up with the two.
See, there's like some mysterious force that's keeping us from talking about Germany and England. We keep getting sidetracked on
this. No, but this is all background to the Germany, England
yeah.
discussion.
Okay.
Because the EG doesn't really manifest in a
right.
board sense.
Until fall,
maybe spring, '02.
Yeah.
Because you have to do the same things because your startup for those two countries really requires you to do a fairly small, you know, fairly narrow universe of stuff.
Good point.
So your EG primarily, as we said, you focus on France, but the strength of it is England is right there to really help you with Russia. So Germany eventually gets to attacking Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You've contained France, and that's what's kind of nice about it. You're able to spread out in a fairly equal fashion as opposed to, you know, FG.
Yep. Well, and also in an EG, you can kind of fight Russia and France at the same time.
Right.
And they can't really do much to help each other. That's sort of the strength of that alliance.
Right.
So the thing that you will be talking to England about right away is Belgium. And that's
yep.
something that I don't know that we've really done a good enough treatment of on this show, because it's sort of a unique space on the board in that it's like more than any other supply center, probably the one that there's no obvious guy who
is the favorite to
get it.
All three have a fairly equal claim to it. I would say Germany has the least, but it's still, you know, it's like 25%.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I agree with you on that even. I mean, I sort of play my Germanies as if someone's got to talk me out of Belgium instead of me yeah. gifting it to somebody else.
Well, it depends on what you... Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, the obvious thing is you can be talking about letting England get down there. Now, this is a, you know, one of those you better know your guy kinds of things, because England's, you know, they'll open, even if they don't open to the Channel and you want to be allies with them, they'll open to the North Sea, they'll open to the Norwegian Sea, and assuming they don't get any sort of a random northern opening from Russia, they can walk right into Norway and then convoy an army down to Belgium. If you let them, or if you help them, and depending on what the French guy has done,
mm-hmm.
obviously, you'd better. So now he's building two. He has that nice strong corner position. You'd better be real sure that if you're letting this happen, you're letting this happen because you're positive that army is coming on down to help.
Right.
It's great to have if you're an EG and you want to just have that extra army as a front against France, but he hasn't really said anything except, hey, thanks for the extra build at that point.
And you know, you get in the England driver's seat, you want that army there.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll go either way. So you need, as Germany, you need to be pretty sure mm-hmm. that this guy is on your side.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you can do if you feel like the England player is, I don't want to say a pushover, but maybe a little less demanding or a little more conservative, is you can say, well, how about I'll get it? And then we'll just go after France. And, you know, maybe he lets you, like, you getting it or him getting it shouldn't preclude or decide.
No.
An England-Germany alliance?
No, it just depends on what the plan is.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go either way.
And if you think that the guy might turn on you, you should probably don't give it to him.
Bounce him out, if nothing else.
Yeah, agree on a bounce.
And that can be good, too.
Come up with some way that a bounce can happen.
There's strength in having a bounce. You look like you're contentious, mm-hmm. and then, you know, keep France off.
Of course, the East loves it when no one can agree on Belgium, because they're like, they're just screwing around.
Well, and then there's strength in that, too. Like, mm-hmm. that means that the East is not trying, they're not trying to go so fast.
Right.
You know, so there are ways that you can make it work. And I agree that the EG, from a German point of view, is pretty good. You really want that. It has a long-term strength.
Yeah.
So I think the long and short of it is, if you're going to deal with England and you're going to try and align with them, make sure that their second build is going to be pro you.
Yeah.
And you need to be pretty sure. Otherwise, I think your default should be denying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could probably ask for Fleet Liverpool only as his second build. I mean, you know, he'll build, either a second army or a Fleet London or something, but then also Fleet Liverpool, because that's something that can basically only be aimed at France.
Make the price of Belgium Fleet Liverpool if you're going to give it to him, but get something, because that relationship can flip on a dime in O2.
Definitely. And of course, now if he does go to the channel or seems inclined to go to the channel, then that's good for you on so many levels. First of all, it's sort of built-in guaranteed conflict between England and France, which gives you so much more romp over the continent.
Yeah.
And second of all, it means that they're not focusing on Belgium, and you might just get it because nobody else is bothering to get it, you know, because they're focused on it. I mean, if there's a bounce in the channel,
that's ideal for you.
It's hallelujah Germany time.
That's good times. But I will say, to disagree with you a little bit, I have certainly opened to the channel and made that an anti-Germany.
Oh, sure.
Sort of.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm just saying, that's not all lollipops and, like, hamsters.
But if you see, say, England opening to the channel, getting there, and also moving his army to Wales.
Well, then he's
that can't be bad for you.
The move to Wales, that's the commitment.
Right, and then you get to pick, because that's just like a straight... Right. A homicidal anti-France move, and then you get to pick. You can go, oh, all right, I'm going to help this psycho and go and pile on France. Or you can go, yeah, that dude's a psycho. Sorry, France. Here, let me help you out.
And just, like, screw that guy.
Yeah.
So now that we're talking about France as much as we are, I think the FG, I am not a huge fan of.
Okay.
Because the only reason I like an FG is because it avoids the whole Maginot Line terribleness.
The only thing worse than allying with France is not allying with France. Yeah. Yeah.
Like if you have no momentum, like for whatever reason, you can't get out of the gate with your EG, definitely go with an FG. I'm not saying it's a bad alliance. I'm just saying, the thing you want to avoid is having France have like three armies in like Burgundy, Marseille, and Gascony, and you just piled up on like Belgium, Ruhr, and Munich, and you guys just looking at each other, flipping each other off. Yeah. That is terrible.
Yeah. The war against France is really hard for either side to win, and England kind of gets to pick.
Oh yeah.
You know,
it's
gonna
awful.
Help. And it's really frustrating, and it goes really slow, unless of course you get the drop on him.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, that's why you want to get the drop on France. You don't want to have a straight up war with France.
Yeah.
That avoid that at all costs, because it will ultimately lose you the game, because the East will get organized before you can break through that.
Unfortunately, sometimes he wants to have an all-out war with you.
Right.
And to be specific for a second, there's that burgundy space, right? Yeah. And you guys can agree to not go there. You can agree to bounce there. But even if you've agreed to bounce there, he can actually, with very little risk to himself, he can support Paris to Burgundy using Marseille, still be bordering Spain so he can take Spain in the fall, and then he's in Burgundy. So sometimes, I mean, and that's obviously...
It's pretty popular.
Yeah, a lot of people do it, and it's not necessarily a declaration of war, but it sure ain't friendly, and Burgundy is not where you would wish that that peace was if you had
anyway, your brothers. But Burgundy is sort of your opening... source of tension, obviously, when you're playing Germany and France and trying to deal with that. And
yeah, so obviously your negotiations, they focus on Burgundy.
Right.
But let's get into, okay, so you focus a lot on this opening negotiation. Right. Why on earth are you going to be working with France? Well, let's say you're forced into it. How's it going to look?
I mean, I suppose there's an argument on the why front for... Just like there's a why for, hey, I'm going to work with England because I don't want France to get big. I'm going to work with France because I don't want England to get big is a thing too. You know, if you're going to go through the trouble of digging out England ever, you might as well do it from the start because that's annoying also.
Well, right. But I guess here's the thing. There's really few Frances that are out there that are willing to open the channel. Right. So the France is just going to, just like we talked about earlier, France is just going to do like its same, mostly grabby. I'm going to get my Iberian Peninsula stuff.
Yeah. So France wants in 1901 is for no one to bother him. So he can go get Spain and Portugal.
That's it. Maybe set up to get Belgium.
Yeah. You can usually make an argument with most Frances that, dude, everybody's already is afraid of you because you're France. You shouldn't get Spain and Portugal and Belgium. That would just be too scary. I mean, if he's the sort that wants that, then you need
to deal with... You're going to be aligning with England anyway.
Yeah, need to deal with that on its merits. But he certainly may want to move a piece to where he can influence Belgium, either Picardy or Burgundy.
Right.
And I suppose the best way to do it is just say, hey, let's just not go to Burgundy so we don't even have to talk about it again.
Right, and you'll find that sometimes.
And that's, I mean, I think that would be my default in most German-France alliances, as I'd say, let's take the first step.
Well, you already France, have that wait and see.
Want to work with, well, sure, yeah, but my point is, I might start it with, hey, if you want to work with me, don't go to Burgundy, and I won't either. You know, that's a good start.
Yeah, but then you have the problem of, we're getting too far down a rabbit hole here. But then you have a problem, like, from the English standpoint. Oh, guess who's working together? Great. Okay. That's...
You really think so? I mean, I don't think. I mean,
you think Germany not going to Burgundy and going to say Ruhr, and France going to Picardy and conspicuously not doing anything in Burgundy? You think that doesn't give like a little?
I mean, in the West, if there's just going to be the slow paced opening where nobody's really tipping their hand yet. I think a lot of times France is going to end up in Picardy instead of Burgundy. For example, like he's going to go to the Mid-Atlantic Ocean, he's going to go to Spain, and he's going to go to Picardy, so he's got something on Belgium. And me as Germany, I'm going to then take my Munich piece and I'm going to move it to Ruhr, right? Because then I can do all kinds of cool stuff from there, like influence Belgium also, and then nobody's going to go to the Channel. So you know, that's just that everybody's going for their neutrals.
If you knew France was making that opening, what you're telling me is you'd go to the Ruhr. You wouldn't go to Burgundy.
Well,
totally. Which, screw their game.
Which is another thing. Yeah, it's kind of fun. I've certainly done it where if I was going to work with England anyway and France was going to be my target anyway and I realized that the French guy just has no interest whatsoever in going to Burgundy, it is kind of fun to just hop right in there.
Well, because, I mean, you can't really do anything other than just totally screw their
game. Yeah, it's true. I mean, but that is a declaration of war. I mean,
it's a declaration of I've just screwed up your game. Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much got to cover everything or gamble it. And, like, you know, if you're feeling frisky as the German, you'll pick up one. I mean, push to Gascony and follow up in Burgundy. It's like,
push to Gascony.
Hello!
Try and guess on Paris. Yeah. Or there's all kinds of fun you can do at that point. Or you can always just go up to Belgium there and he'll feel like you did him a favor.
You're definitely getting the feeling on this sugar program that we are a little bit more EG than FG.
Well, I don't know. You may be. FGs can work. We haven't really even talked about it. And maybe we'll talk a little about it later. But we haven't even talked about all of the nasty... like fleet stuff you can do if you really are just making England your target and France really does just grab the English Channel, then he can, you know, he can support you into the North Sea from Denmark in the fall, which is beautiful. I mean, it doesn't work incredibly often, but if it does work, wow, you're in the North Sea in the fall of 01, and that's kind of cool. But you know, yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, moving on.
I mean, well, yeah, just be... We'll talk with our guests later about, you know, what the optimal strategy is in the opening with your neighbors. But I think just want to arm you, the listener, with some things to be thinking about with your primary neighbors, with your theater mates.
Yep.
So hopefully that gives you a little something to go on with France. I guess that leaves us with Russia, which not in your theater per se, but it is definitely one of the three you're going to interact with the most.
Definitely the guy you got to be thinking about next is Russia. And he's probably in the medium term, probably your most important neighbor of all.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't deal with him that much right away. I mean, your main interaction with him usually before the spring of 01 is, can I have Belgium? Sweden.
Sweden.
Yeah. Can I have Sweden?
Well, yeah, maybe. The Sweden thing is, I think we need to take a second to talk about it because, you know, unless you're going for the three, you're probably in Denmark.
More Germans open.
I mean, it's a little bit less aggressive. It's a guarantee, really.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to stop you from going in there. Holland is as well, but I mean, it's just one of those things. It's so routine that it's predictable. Mm-hmm. People don't, it doesn't ruffle any feathers. And you immediately have this question.
Mm-hmm.
That the entire board is coming to you with, and it's like whether or not you bounce
the Russian.
And it's completely dependent on the board, but what you need to be able to do, and what we're hoping to explain to you really quick, don't just do it to do it.
Yeah,
make sure you're doing it with purpose,
mm-hmm.
because it can have a profound effect on the board. I mean, it's the veritable butterfly that starts the wind that ends up in a hurricane that can really cascade downstream if you're not careful.
Yeah, I agree. And honestly, if your reason is, well, I just don't want him to have Sweden because I want it for myself, that's not actually that good of a reason.
Yeah,
because
not a reason at
all. Whether he gets it or doesn't get it, if you're really planning on opening a strong Scandinavian front, like if you're working with England, you can do it anyway.
Yeah, you're going to do it anyway.
He gets it in the spring, but he can't back it up. He's got that lone fleet sitting all up there by itself. And even if he builds another northern piece to back it up, there's still not that much he can do against you and England if what you really want to do is just take it from him the next year.
Right. And moreover, if you're going to launch a campaign like that, if you want to encourage a build in the north, bounce him.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, by letting him have it, you increase the chances that he's not going to have anything in St. Petersburg, and he thinks he can have another season on it, and mm-hmm. he builds it down south, where frankly, you know, 9 times out of 10, he's going to need it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're planning to have Sweden, just wait a season because you're going to be building that extra fleet and going up there anyway. It's going to be yours.
So if you are bouncing him, it's usually more, well, I mean, one reason I guess I'd do it is if I felt like there was an RT bubbling to the surface, because then that's just something that weakens it a little bit. It takes a build away from their coalition. RTs are bad in the long term for you, just like almost everybody else on the board. I feel like we've been banging that drum on every episode we've done so far, except the Russia episode.
Well, it just comes up so often.
Yeah, it's just a consideration.
Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that, and I think that's the bottom line. We can go through 1,000 permutations of reasons to do it and reasons not to do it. Just make sure your reason is your reason is justified by the amount of overall impact that bounce will have on the board, because it will profoundly change your relationship with the Russian, and it will definitely alter what's going on in the East.
Yep. And to sort of take one step back, instead of just talking about Sweden and whether you do or don't deny him Sweden in 1901, the normal general thing to remember when you're dealing with Russia is that at some point in the mid game, or even the early-ish game, one of you is coming for the other.
Oh, yeah.
Almost all the time. It's whoever's doing better. If Germany finds an ally and is knocking down France, he's probably coming for Russia with it pretty quick. And if Russia is doing well, he's probably coming for you pretty quick. And you just need to do what you can to make it so that you get to go first.
Right. A lot of the German game is about getting that jump. Mm-hmm. You want to be the first. And that's, I think, one of the reasons it happened so early. Both Russia and Germany are sort of eyeing each other like, okay, yep. when can I go? When can I go? And like, okay, I don't quite have it, but I got to start now because I'm going to need that extra season. So,
of course, you're noticing us not talking about how the right time to do that is spring 1901.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
It almost never is. Or well,
I'm going to say 99.9% of the time.
Yeah, never, yeah. It just because it doesn't work. And I know we talked about it in the Russia episode. It doesn't work from them to you. It doesn't work from you to them because you can never gain anything. You just don't have the force to crawl over that stalemate line and try and take stuff right away.
And we'll tick through that when we go through the openings really quick because we're kind of half talking about it. We'll explicitly go through the openings in a few minutes here.
Okay. Austria.
Austria. You want to go Austria next?
Yeah. Because I think Austria, I mean, there's a lot of statistical kind of correlation between games where Germany's too good, Austria's too good. They're sort of your little brother across the stalemate line, at least early on. Well,
historically, you're Germanic sort of.
There's no good plan for either of them that involves attacking the other one very early on.
No, there really isn't.
If each of you knows that the other one is a friend and they don't have to really worry about defending against the other one, then it's just such a weight off of you to just know, all right, well, if there's one part of my butt that I don't have to cover, it's that part of my butt.
Yeah. And actually I would go a step further. You don't have to know. I think as a German player or an Austrian player, you just assume it.
Yeah.
And if you just have to play as if that is just not enough, you have enough things to worry about. If that actually does happen, the game is doomed anyway.
Also,
you
know what I mean? Weak Austrias are probably weak because they're getting killed by juggernauts.
Yep.
And you're going to be...
You're next. Next course.
Yep. And so if Austria is doing well, it's probably because there's not a juggernaut, or if there is, it's an incredibly incompetent one. And so Austria is doing well can be good for you. When you go into Russia, if Austria is fighting Russia also, you guys can actually start coordinating a little bit. So there's a lot of reasons to actually be rooting for Austria early on in the game and also be telling them a fair amount of the truth about what's going on your side of the board and sort of swapping gossip.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the moral of the story here is take a few minutes to talk to the Austrian and get to know them.
Yeah.
There's nothing really tactically you need to talk about, but definitely, you know, encourage them to, you know, take them into your confidence a little bit.
Take them into your confidence and sort of look out for them, you know, negotiate on their behalf.
Just like, hey, you know what? I know Italy's going to make this move. They talked to me about it. They want permission in Tyrolia. Mm-hmm. I gave it to them, but FYI, you may want to bounce it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
or I've even done one other thing. I'll do this from time to time. I'll go to the Russian and say, hey, I'll let you have Sweden as long as you're not in Galicia. After spring, because Russians in Galicia are pretty bad for Austria, and Austria might want to do something a little better, and I'll say, hey, it's all yours, just leave the poor Austrian alone.
Right.
And that little thing right there can really change boards with the right Russian and the right Austrian. The Russian will go, oh, well, maybe I should do something better than just team up with Turkey and go attack Austria.
I'm sure what they do is they go and arrange the balance is what.
Yeah, well, and if that's the bounce and that's okay with Austria, then you've accomplished a goal anyway. At least he's not getting jumped, you know, which is what you don't want. Because if he gets jumped, Russia gets really big really fast and he goes first.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
I think I'm with you there.
Okay.
I think it's a little weird, but I don't think it's weird at all. So the Italian.
Yeah, is the other part of that equation.
The Italian's a little different, though. And you know, if you've listened to the Italian episode, you know our feelings on it extensively about this particular maneuver, but sometimes the Italians decide to go north.
Yes, they do.
And it's an unfortunate fact of life that an Italian opening to Tyrolia is something you do have to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's rarely good for Italy.
A lot of times they'll do that and then someone will talk them into starting that premature campaign against you.
It's not good for the Italians, as we covered ad nauseum.
What you can do, though, is if you just get the feeling that's going to happen, you can always just bounce in with Munich.
You can, but here's the problem.
You'd rather use Munich for something else, but
That's the secondary problem. The primary problem is if you're wrong.
If you're wrong, yeah.
That sucks.
It's not so terrible. Munich to Tyrolia working.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little terrible. I don't know. It depends what everyone else does.
Yeah, but with France and Burgundy.
Well, that's pretty terrible. Yeah, that's pretty terrible.
And you decided to go for three.
Well, then you can just go to Piedmont from there.
You can just, hello.
Yeah. Just,
you know, but that's, I would think, not always. You can make it work. Mm-hmm. I have seen it work with the dropping down to Tyrolia as the German, but... It's not where you want to be. It doesn't concentrate your forces very well. And look at me talking like an expert on Germany.
Well.
But I have not seen it work out.
No, it's, again, 99% of the time I do it because I'm sure that the Italian's coming up there and I just don't want him to for whatever reason. And it is kind of satisfying. It's just one of those, sit down, get back in your hole. Play nice, you two, you know, so that could be, longer term, similar to Russia, might just come across before you're ready for him to. Austria, Italy's sometimes an alliance, and then
AI pops up there a little faster than you're ready.
Yeah, you get into this habit of like you're playing nice for the first couple of years. They're working together. It's central solidarity. It's all good, and then all of a sudden, in about spring 03 or something, there's like green and red units all over your junk.
This is the worst Christmas ever.
Yeah, exactly. and I feel like that's a trap I fall into because I just sort of, I'm always so much busier with something else that I'm like, they're my buddies. And then the next thing I know, they've just all decided, what the heck, let's go for Munich. We don't know where we're going to grow
suddenly
next.
Suddenly they're like a little line of Christmas lights between like Tyrolia and Silesia. You're just like, what the
exactly,
heck?
Exactly. So keep an eye on those little border spaces, see what they're doing with their armies, see if their armies seem otherwise occupied. Right. Keep talking to them. Don't just take for granted that they're your friends, even if they're your friends at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And keep it, like I said earlier, like make sure you're having a conversation with these people. Mm-hmm. Because the person you don't really have to have a huge amount of conversation with, but definitely always good to talk to, is Turkey.
I got one more thing on Italy.
No.
Before we go.
No.
Oh, please.
Oh, all right.
How about trying to talk him into going to Piedmont?
The Italian?
I
think that only works on a grand scale. I think you can only, you can't commit, that almost requires an EG.
Because
the Italian's not going to do it.
If you're feeling good about the EG, recruiting that extra piece.
It's completely necessary if you're going to do a full-on assault.
Definitely.
Because otherwise it's that Maginot Line slog I was talking about. Mm-hmm. That sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But tips the balance is like that really annoying Italian player that apparently is going to fall on his sword and waste a whole bunch of his life.
Well, you can promise him Marseille and...
Oh, yeah. Marseille by 02.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not great for Italy, but...
It can be under the right circumstances.
It can be.
I said in the Italy episode, sometimes I'll do it not really planning on growing a ton out there, but just sort of being opportunistic, you know?
Sure.
And ask your Italy, especially if you think you're going to work with England, and just kind of float it. Say, hey, thinking about it at all? Sometimes they'll go, maybe.
I'm remiss. You should always ask.
That was my point.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. We can talk Turkey now.
But not really.
Yeah.
Because there's not really much to talk. It's one of those instances where, like, this is probably a sidebar, but I'd say England has more to talk to Turkey about.
I agree.
Than Germany.
Well, you and England have the same thing to talk to Turkey about, which is Russia.
Yeah.
You know, what's your plan? You might... I think the thing that I'm talking to Turkey about in 01, and mind you, it's time permitting, because it's
bottom
really not that
bottom
important.
Of the list, right?
The thing I suppose I'm talking to them is for him is trying to figure out, is there the juggernaut? If so, he might be able to sway my opinion one way or the other on the Sweden thing.
Right. I'll have the, so you're bouncing or not conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the question to him. It's like, okay, you're bouncing, you're not. Just try and get an idea of whether or not Russia is going north. I think it just essentially repeated you, but yeah.
Sometimes they'll come to you and they'll say, hey, are you thinking of denying him Sweden? And they might be trying to make up their mind about whether they're going to attack. And so you guys might both decide like, well, if I do it, you do it. And we'll make
let's
Russia's
munch
life.
Him.
Exactly. So a little something there.
Okay, so that's all your neighbors and distant neighbors.
Yep.
So do we want to just tick through really quick? I think it's helpful. Let's just talk about some typical opening moves. As we said earlier, there's not really any gambits.
Right.
So there's a lot of kind of standard openings, and I want to highlight, mostly what I want to highlight is what not to do.
Okay.
Let's
go for it.
Let's start there. Like, there, you've got your three pieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your Munich, your Berlin, your Kiel.
Mm-hmm.
The thing you cannot do, and please never do this, do not open to Silesia and Prussia, no matter how awesome it looks,
yeah.
No matter how many Napoleonic novels you've read,
yeah.
No matter how many times you've thought about the Blitzkrieg across Poland,
but really,
don't do it.
And tell them why.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why, but
yeah.
I think the primary reason why is, like, there's an EF on the back,
exactly.
on your backside.
Yeah.
And that's just like pulling down your pants and saying, hey,
yeah.
I'm not busy.
Mm-hmm.
Take what you'd like.
Yeah, the gods of diplomacy were kind enough to place all those supply centers really, really near you.
Exactly.
You should help yourself to those supply centers.
And
Holland,
running
Denmark,
away from
Belgium.
Them is just like saying, I don't really want to play this game today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Warsaw is a dot too, sure.
Yeah,
but
sure. You got to work for that dot.
Exactly, whereas the other ones, I mean, I'm hard-pressed to ever find anyone who doesn't just automatically agree by default that Holland and Denmark are supposed to belong to you.
Oh, yeah.
There's no one on Earth who's just going to be like, well, Holland is my rightful space, you know, no England
no.
or whatever. If they can trick
you.
Because
it's too hard to get to.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, the North Sea borders it, but it's one of those things, like, you are potentially already in it, or you're... If you've gone to Denmark, you've already got probably two,
mm-hmm.
or at least one on Holland, and...
Mm-hmm.
England's really going to be looking for the easy grab. They
yep.
need to build one minimum.
Yep.
Probably want two.
Yep.
So there's just that's the only message I think if you take nothing else away from this episode, never do that.
Okay, but now let's assume they're not going to do that and talk
okay.
about the actual differences in the openings that most Germans use under most circumstances.
Well, why don't you start with your I'm going to rule the world, give me three.
Well, okay. The optimal, I suppose. The
interesting word choice, optimal.
If I could draw up my Germany, how I wanted to do it, I want Holland, Denmark, and Belgium, though.
Okay.
And the way that I'm going to do that, let's start with the fleet, because I think the fleet...
That's really where the pudding is. Right?
The fleet goes to either Holland or Denmark.
Right.
And then the army in Berlin just follows it, planning on going to that other space in the fall, if nothing bad happens, right?
Yes.
So Berlin to Kiel, Kiel to Holland or Denmark. Okay?
Right.
Denmark, all of that stuff that we talked about in terms of bouncing the Russian out of Sweden... Denmark is, I think, the more common of the
yeah.
two, and it's not just for bouncing Russia out of Sweden reasons.
No.
It's just because Denmark is a more friendly place for a fleet, generally.
Yeah, you've got it gives you more options.
It gives you a lot more options,
and you have less leverage and fun stuff you can do in Holland with that fleet.
If you go to Holland with the fleet, if you've also gone to Ruhr from Munich, then you've got your very own supported attack on Belgium. So that's actually your strongest play on Belgium. But the trade-off is then you just have to walk an army by itself, the army in Kiel. You've just got to walk it up to Denmark and hope that you get Denmark. And
Munich is hanging open.
Well, okay. Not even talking about any of what threatens that. I'm just saying that you have to trade a stronger play on Belgium versus a stronger play on Denmark.
Oh, I see.
You see what I'm saying? So in other words, if you've gone to Holland, Ruhr, and Kiel as your opening moves, then in the fall, you're usually, unless something bad has happened to Munich, you know, so unless somebody's threatening Munich unexpectedly, your plan is then you want to support yourself into Belgium, but then in order to secure Denmark, you're just going Kiel to Denmark with an army.
Right.
England can theoretically bounce this. He won't usually
will
because
not.
He's usually more interested in somewhere else than Denmark.
But you would
have
to
piss
him off.
Exactly. Exactly. But the other downside to it is that then if you do that, then you have an army in Denmark, which is a bummer in
yeah.
1902, because an army in Denmark can go exactly two places, back to Kiel or Sweden. You know, Denmark likes a fleet. And
yeah, and then you're actually just relegated to a guard post because
right.
because Russia has taken Sweden at this point. So
yeah.
So then you're kind of sitting there, and it's difficult. Then you have to figure
mm-hmm.
out how to move it,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
almost
and then
necessitates
even if you...
a fleet Kiel build. I mean, you kind of...
Yeah.
That's the thing about that opening is once you get the army there, you're kind of on this path.
Mm-hmm. But the trade-off is that you've got a stronger position on
on Belgium, and so maybe you actually took Belgium in 1901.
The trade-off is like, you have a campaign in Scandinavia because you have all these units you got to put somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly.
So, that's the classic three build.
Yep,
I don't know if there's a word for it. I really like
German centers. War machine.
Yeah,
like it, I don't know how much we covered this already, but the German, I think, can get away with a three build opening.
Yeah, you mentioned that
probably already. More than any other country on the board. Like, no one's ever as freaked out by that as three build France's so and three build Russia's just put people into hysterics. Whereas three build Germany's, they make hysterical. People nervous. But
I agree, it's the lowest of the threat levels.
Yeah,
I think it's because it's so easy to do, and Germany's so centralized that people feel they don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes it, and I think it's I disagree. I think in some ways that I think it provokes a reaction.
It can.
If you're looking to try and go a little bit further, if you don't have the right environment, being three might be too much. But then there's other environments in which getting that three is perfect because you just have the right combination of people around and you can get that momentum. So
then back to the more common one then. And you can still get three if you open with a fleet to Denmark, but you'd have to just have permission to walk right into all three, basically.
Which is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. So now you've gone, now taking it the other way, you've gone your fleet to Denmark, your army
to Kiel,
and your Munich army again to Ruhr.
Right.
Ruhr just being a flexible position that if you feel like you can get away with it, you should always try and get there. You could support yourself into Holland if you feel like you have to. But again, England is probably not going for Holland. He probably has something better to do. You could move one army to Holland, another one to Belgium, but probably somebody else is going to at least try and move to Belgium. So that one will often bounce. You can support it up the other way. You know, you have options. Right. Yeah.
You have options, and I think this is it's a whole different ball of wax if you get three builds that way than with a
definitely
because you have the opt in the acknowledgement that that's going to happen by either France or England.
Definitely.
So you
didn't force it.
You didn't force it, and someone else, you have a teammate who's like, yes, I want this to happen.
It can also happen that way if they bounced in the channel.
Yeah,
that's absolutely. Another thing.
That doesn't happen that often. Yeah. That's
where you're all of a sudden you realize, oh, nobody else is really even bordering Belgium. I might as well.
Typically, Paris doesn't go down to Gascony. Well, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess they might go to Gascony because Marseille went to Spain so that they could push all their armies down into Iberia. Mm-hmm. And already this France isn't doing so well.
Yeah.
They're getting that back. I'm going to stuff all my armies back into the tail of my country. And I'm going to ram my fleet into the English.
Take that, nobody.
Take that. I'm going to slowly wither and die.
Yeah.
So those are really the two openings, right?
Well, and then another follow up on that one is that can be really nice from time to time is you move your fleet to Denmark, your armies to Ruhr and Kiel, and then you go Ruhr to Holland, knowing that it's going to succeed. Then you could slide your fleet to Skagerrak and your other army up to Denmark.
Yeah.
And now you've got like a legitimate Scandinavia front and a nice position. So that's flexible also. And then not in that one, but in most of the ones we've talked about, you actually are still preserving the bounce the Russian out of Sweden option.
Right.
So that, I think that's why that's the most popular opening.
Because I think you have a lot more, the fall follow up to it has more flexibility. You can react better to the point.
Yep, you absolutely can.
And you can still get to the same three. So that one, I think I would say, I don't know, I'm shooting from the hip here, but at least 50-60% of the time, you see that.
It's
a high percentage of the time.
Yeah. It might even be higher, you're right.
The only twist on it is the move to Ruhr.
Yeah, exactly. Because we're taking for granted in everything we've talked about so far that Ruhr is something you, A, feel like you can do, and B, feel like you want to do. There's a lot of times when Munich is going to be otherwise occupied because either the French guy made you agree to a bounce in Burgundy. You felt like you had to bounce somebody out of Tyrolia. Even occasionally, unfortunately, you have to agree to a bounce in Silesia.
Yeah.
This happens. I've had that Russian. Like, if he's just, like, you've had a bad game with him before and he just doesn't trust you, he's like, all right, let's just bounce in Silesia. And you're like, oh, really?
Are you kidding?
Yeah. But you don't want him there.
No.
So he may as well bounce him.
Screw his game.
Yeah. If you just let him go.
If you just let him go and you were able to build in Berlin and kick him out again. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's what we call a tangent.
Yeah.
And that's northern two units, Berlin and Kiel, those are pretty consistent. Like,
yeah,
you can do...
Those are there to get you neutrals.
And
the vast majority
it really
of the
doesn't
time.
Matter what's going on with the rest of the board. They're probably going to do either one of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is really Munich. So that's where the rubber hits the road in really trying to figure out, okay, what can I reasonably get away with here?
Mm-hmm. So I guess a simple way to put it would be that early on, if you're not sure what to do as Germany, your diplomatic objective should be making sure that Munich doesn't have anything more pressing to do than go to work.
Yeah, that should be your goal.
Because that gives you a ton of flexibility. We're also, by the way, borders Burgundy, and so that gives you those options coming up. Okay, one exception to what I just said. If you've just made up your mind that you're just going to Burgundy.
Well, right.
I guess there's always that.
But that's it. Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. When you're doing all that diplomacy to try and make sure that Munich is so unthreatened it can go to Ruhr, you might be creating a situation in which Burgundy is wide open. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's the same.
That's true. That's true. So I guess that's a good sort of beginner's tip to Germany is just find a way to make it that Munich to Ruhr is something that is okay and is not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Now, even times that you do that, obviously, you might be unpleasantly surprised when the orders get read and somebody didn't do what they said they were going to do. Either the French guy actually did go to Burgundy or the Italian guy went to Tyrolia. And at that point, you're sort of in the realm of time to improvise, time to figure out, you know, do I need to cover Munich? Do I need to supported cover Munich? Do I even want to cover Munich?
Right.
Do I want to self-bounce in Munich? There's
a million things to do. But I think it's a good tip to say, if you are just trying to learn how to play Germany, think about Ruhr as your goal.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be, obviously, I shouldn't have to say it, but just in case, don't advertise that as your goal. But, you know, quietly think, okay, how can I make this situation such that I don't have to worry about something in Tyrolia or something in Burgundy really bothering me?
Yeah.
Because ideally, Ruhr, Holland, Denmark in the fall, that's a nice place to be. So, I mean...
Or Kiel, Ruhr,
and Denmark. Either or. Nice position to have.
Yeah, exactly. And Ruhr is a space that is going to be something that you're going to need to protect pretty much all game. It's bad when bad guys end up in the Ruhr.
Sure, every country has one of these. Like, it's a key center.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Ruhr... well, it depends.
I don't know. Baltic's pretty bad, too. I don't know which one's worse for the German.
I don't want to go down. We're going to talk about this when we talk about stalemates in another episode.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to get to the point where Ruhr is key to holding that line. Mm-hmm. It's that one.
It's important for offense and defense. It borders, you know, obviously it borders Burgundy, but it also borders Holland and Belgium, and there's dots there. And so if you're working with France, I guess maybe your short-term goal with him is to kind of get stuff in there, but then get stuff right back out of there again, you know, come up with some kind of an agreement
on Belgium
and then try and have it so that it's not this constant source of tension where there's so much stuff bordering each other's lowland centers that you can just never relax and do what you should be doing, which is attacking England.
All right. So that's how you open as Germany. That's something.
Anything else we need to cover on
openings? Not for openings. There's just not a lot out
crazy
there.
Crazy, but you don't want to talk about Bohemia?
Oh, God.
our friend's favorite ridiculous opening, the Munich to Bohemia opening.
We're not going to talk about that.
That's
just a war story, really.
Yeah, it pretty much is.
So you've opened up.
Mm-hmm.
You're driving the German war machine successfully.
Yeah.
It's now, let's say, 1903. You've either chosen a war with one of your three neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And things are going pretty well.
Yeah. So a little bit about, like, the mid-game progress on both the EG and the FG, I guess. if it's the EG, by the mid game, you may well not have killed France. But you've at least neutralized him because he's notoriously a pain to dig out, especially if he's gotten Portugal and Spain, then you've got to get all the way down there. England's probably getting those.
Yeah.
You're probably getting, you know, the lowland centers and Paris and Marseille, or so. And he's probably getting Brest in the ones up there.
And don't be afraid to just maroon the guy. Like, you can sit, it only takes two units to just plug him up with two armies in Iberia. Mm-hmm. You just need one thing in Gascony and one thing in Marseille, and just don't be afraid to neutralize and turn and do something else. You can pick up those centers a little bit later. I think a lot of times when dealing with people like France or things like Turkey, who are really difficult to dig out, England's another example. If you get them down to one or two centers, you might have a lot better things to do.
So yeah, don't definitely. Be like I think
butcher about it.
Even if you made France's life more difficult than you're making Russia's life, the majority of your force should be up in Russia and other eastern and northern destinations by then. For both of you and your ally. Although you probably, I mean, England's probably got an uncomfortable amount of fleets in sort of northern seas.
Oh, I mean, as an alliance that you're neutralizing,
right?
For the good of, I'm merely giving that advice simply because a lot of people, I think, feel the need to really utterly just wipe someone from the map.
Oh yeah, definitely, the next person. Definitely. But you would want England in his moving on, I guess. You'd want him to be more fleets than armies, and you'd want him to start sailing around the Mediterranean at that point, right?
He should already be in the Mediterranean by the time that you're talking about. I mean, in that specific scenario, like Iberia, maroon two armies, like he should already be in the Mediterranean and fanning out into Russia.
It can turn scary in a hurry for the German. That, like, I think a lot of people feel like they don't like the EG because they think it's so much better for England. Because England, you know, you knock down France, you knock down Russia, and then, hey, oh, why don't I just, you know, Germany's all turned east, why don't I just fill in behind him? And I think that's why that alliance makes some people nervous, is because by the mid-game, it can advantage England. So as a German, you kind of want to be encouraging your English guy to kind of stay fleets and get going to the Med early. Just be like, I'll take the center. You go around.
Right.
And that can work. It's not even necessarily a bad deal for England.
It's a fine deal.
It's just what you have to watch out for. If he's just like cranking armies down into France, you're like, whoa, hold on. Why do you need a fourth army down there? That's when you want to start being careful. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I think that's a piece of general advice. Mm-hmm. I mean, never stop having the conversation with your ally about what your expectations of the alliance are. You mean, keep talking about the plan. And don't ever let your ally get bored.
That's
the key. Like, keep having a plan. Keep having a goal that isn't you.
It's never too soon to bring up that next target. Hey, we're working well together, so you're going to go after Italy now, right? Right.
That's where we're going, right? I got this plan here. What do you think? What do you want to do? The second that your ally starts not talking to you about, like, the next thing, it's like, oh, yeah, we're going well. Things very general. Be worried.
Yeah, you might be next. Although in practice, I'd say that England-Germany alliances specifically, while that's the goal, that's what you should be shooting for, you're usually a little bit kind of tangled up with blue and black in Russia and Scandinavia. There's probably, you know, you're helping each other there, and who owns St. Pete is not the same every time, or who owns even...
Well, that whole front up there is messy.
Yeah, it can get twisted up, which is fine. I mean, it's just going to be that way, but yeah. I guess I'd say, really, in either alliance, if you're with England or you're with France, lay your claim to Russia. That's how to get that war machine continuing to crank. Is stretch far in Warsaw, Moscow, St. Pete, early targets. You know, and maybe even Austrian centers.
The thing about that is you have to, because otherwise St. Pete's not going to fall.
Yep.
I mean, you know, England cannot break St. Pete almost ever by itself. It's going to need some help from you if you're going to be successful. Especially, you can eventually crack it. But if you want any sort of speed, you're going to need to be there.
Exactly.
Stretched out.
Exactly.
So what about FG?
The France-Germany, It's a little more awkward early on, I agree, because, you know, you have to get all those fleets up there to actually eliminate England. Mm-hmm. But once you've done that, it's actually a little cleaner in terms of getting disentangled, because you can just go northeast while they go southeast. You know, that it's much more obvious for if you can manage to not fall into each other's center as well. Taking out England, you know, you've presumably built some northern fleets and you've presumably like had to go and do that slog to actually bust up England. At that point, you can just sort of synchronized swimmer, like just sort of untangle. And then he goes around down south and then you just keep going into Russia. And that one, I feel like if you can get through it in the short term without stabbing each other, I feel like longer term, it keeps itself a little more separate because it's less obvious that you There's have to go through paranoia. Each other. Yeah, exactly.
And so, that Maginot line that we talked about before, that it's such a pain early on, is actually a great deterrent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the later game.
Yeah.
So you kind of gotta figure out what works better for you. I think if you're someone that doesn't like that paranoid feeling late in the game with your ally, that can actually maybe lean you towards one type of one of the two alliances. Maybe go France. But you gotta, I mean, there's pros and cons.
No, I agree. You gotta, I guess one question that I have, one thing I'm sort of thinking about that we haven't touched on at all, is what if for whatever reason, just diplomatically or tournament reasons or anything else, you actually just don't want to fight Russia? Like you and the Russian just work well together. I mean, how does that look on the board?
Well,
I think we spent all of the Russia episode talking about be terrified of Germany and all the Germany episode now talking about be terrified of Russia. And that's because that's how a lot of the games go. But
it can work, but that's almost an FG by default. And I think you risk setting up a situation in which the RF really just squishes you at some point. But let's say you and Russia are Germany and Russia are doing really well and you just aim for whatever reason you feel solid about this.
Yeah.
The problem becomes it's really, really difficult for you to do much else against France alone because you have to have someone. And
well, I guess maybe what you've done is say, for example, worked with France and killed England and then you decide and just sort of ignored Russia. Mm-hmm. And then you just decide at that point to stab France.
Yeah.
Instead of doing what the more obvious thing is, which is go after Russia,
that can
happen.
What works well, actually, in this scenario, and probably how it came about, is if you're doing a sea lion and you have Russia's help to take down England, and he has a fleet or two, and you're sort of all working together to take out England, it's a lot easier to kind of transition those extra fleets that he has nothing else to do with and say, hey, France is next on the list.
But that's true. That kind of
envelops you a little bit.
Yeah, it's dangerous. You better hope he's got some pressure on his south if that's happening. Otherwise
you're setting up a solo.
Yeah. If you've got a Russian that's got like five northern units and you're helping him, you better hope that those are five of his seven units. Or
reevaluate the help.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Unless you're just transporting all the, you know, expatriate Russians to the new England, their new land, you know.
What about the long-term with AI? I mean, I guess we talked about a little bit how they can sort of unpleasantly just show up at your doorstep in the mid-game. What about working with them and or attacking them in the mid-game? Is that...
Well, I think this is a good transition into a little something, because I think... For Germany, more than almost every other country, you need to be aware of those stalemate lines, which is what the AI question is really about. Yeah. The reason AI is pushing up there that early is to get the jump on the stalemate line, because they think they're ready for it, or they have enough you know, three or four free units that they can start setting up a semblance of it.
And this is the good part of Germany and also the bad part of Germany. If you're doing well as Germany, hey, you're right on those stalemate lines and you're the one who gets to dive across them. And that's why, you know, Germans have decent soloing prospects compared to some of the other countries, compared to, say, England.
You get to build on the stalemate line.
Literally on the stalemate line. Kind of like Munich and Berlin are both on the stalemate line and you can build there as it becomes necessary. And so if you're the guy with the momentum, if you're the guy with the initiative, then you're just cranking them out and sending them across. And across, we've mostly talked so far, being toward Russia, but it...
Yeah, it could be south.
It frequently is, you know, especially at that point in the game where maybe you and your ally are really trying to make a hard push across the line, or even just you on your own.
Especially if it's a well-developed FG. You know, there's a time where you drop down. Tyrolia, Bohemia.
Mm-hmm.
Boom.
Yeah, yeah. Vienna, I think, is a pretty frequent late-game to mid-game German conquest. Mm-hmm. Much further into Austria can be kind of hard to hold. Like, you know, you're doing really good if you're if you've got Budapest.
Well, you tend to, if you're in that FG, you're eroding the Italian a little well. Because
The Italian's falling apart because he's got French pressure on him. Yeah, that can be strong. Yeah,
but you're not gonna get hugely far. But you know,
If you're looking to solo as Germany, there's a lot of Eastern centers that you only really need one of if you win the West. Right. You know, which you can do win the West. I mean, you might not win the whole West, but even so, getting three or four across the line isn't out of the question.
Now,
the flip side of that, of course, is that if they're coming, they're coming for you first. And that's the part of Germany I know that you hate and that is incredibly unfun to play, is the Germany that just goes from like, I'm just doing my thing on my side of the board, and then the next thing...
Ow!
Yeah, next thing, your whole job becomes to hold the line against somebody, some coalition that's coming from the other way. And at that point, that's where Germany's just fail. And that's why you have to just not be that Germany. You have to just get across
that's kind of the really shitty part about it.
Like, yeah.
The only way to avoid it is just don't be. I mean, and that's really, you're not wrong. It's like, just don't be. What the hell is that?
You know, be a good enough diplomat to make sure that the guys who might be jumping across either don't want to because you're such a nice guy or aren't capable because they have bigger problems that you're engineering, or, you know, that's the trick.
But I think we've really touched on one of the last things I want to talk about. The reason that we've just talked about the stalemate lines, getting that jump, trying to make sure that doesn't happen, that feeling of just not great sitting on Berlin, Kiel, and Munich and just holding.
Mm-hmm.
That is why there exists in this world the Western Triple.
Oh, that's where you were going. It's like, what is Nathan doing here? I don't like it. It's making me feel funny inside. Feeling,
that is a huge reason why Germany's agree to the Western Triple. The Western Triple, I think we've talked about
before. Yeah, we covered a little bit before. Yeah. It's just where all three of them work.
All three of them work together, and, you know, that fanning motion that England would have that we were talking about, that England would just do that to the north, France would do it to the south, Germany would do it to the middle. Generally, Germany does this for two reasons. One, I just suggested, it's really crappy to be on the receiving end, and sometimes it just feels good to just go.
Just dive across early.
Yeah. Sometimes it just feels good and you just fall for it. The other one is if EF come to you and say, hi, we're going to do this with you or without you.
Yeah, we're having an alliance anyway. would you like to be in it or not?
Yeah, or just should you just hand over your dots in a really excruciating way?
Yeah, and that happens.
It happened to me. Definitely. But I think it's, you do see triples. You don't see them as much as there was like a three-year heyday.
Right? Yeah.
It's like, woohoo, triple time.
They still make sense from time to time. I just hate them. I don't know. And you're especially supposed to, the conventional wisdom is you're especially supposed to hate them when you're Germany.
Right.
Because they've recruited you to turn your back totally to them and go after some more difficult conquests while they get to be helped by that. Usually the thing that I'll say if people are brainstorming about it pre-01 is, I get three.
Yeah, so that's my price as well.
I get Denmark, I get Holland, I get Belgium. I'm in.
I'm building all armies and let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you follow through with that.
Yeah.
Sometimes people will balk at that.
Yeah, and then you realize they weren't that serious about a Western Triple anyway, and they were really just trying to trick you into going elsewhere than them. Because then at least you know.
And it kind of frays, like, you know, once you let the cat out of the bag about an alliance like that, it kind of tends to fray it a little bit.
Yeah.
The problem with the Western Triple, for those of you out there, especially I think people that haven't played a huge number of games, there's a certain amount of appeal to it. I find that newer players, they like the commitment and the camaraderie.
It's free to core.
I think that happens a lot. And that, you know, if you want to try it out there, listeners, go for it. I definitely think it's a great experience.
And if you're playing England or France and you feel like you can talk a German into it, by all means,
try it out. But one thing that I think it is not always clear is a Western Triple or any Triple Alliance tends to create a triple on the other side of the board to balance it.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that you're just going to swoop over the line almost doesn't, it almost never happens because people see it coming and they organize very quickly and they,
yeah. People panic about Western yeah. triples almost as much as they panic about juggernauts. You know, mm-hmm. they're rarer, and so it's usually much ado about nothing. And I feel like when you're playing, somebody accuses the West of having a Western always. Triple at least once per game. Ah, it's a triple C.
Triple C?
Yeah.
Well, it can be a great tactic on your side just to, like, break up that side or to, like, scare someone on your side. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to get Italy to just sort of go west to no good effect whatsoever.
Exactly. Like
yeah.
There could be reasons for it. I mean, yeah. There's all sorts of, you know, scare people. It's fun.
Yeah.
But I think that's try out the triple, know that the triple turns out to really be kind of a dead end, and that is where the warning comes in. So once you hit that dead end, EF is like, well, we're at a dead end. I'm hungry. How about you?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So know that you're not going to be flying across, building stuff in the back. You're probably going to get stymied and then eaten.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, you know, yeah. if you like these two guys, you feel like you got a good thing going.
Yeah, it could be your best friend.
You say, hey, I get three, and they say, fair enough. Yeah. I understand why you would want that, and they give you three. All right, I'm going after Russia in 0-2. Here I go.
Right,
and it can be cool, you know. But it's all just different methods of doing that, avoiding that thing where you're the German that can't move.
Right.
Anymore. Because again, when somebody's coming across the stalemate line, they're usually coming at you. Or for that matter, when somebody's coming, you know, when an EF is coming, it's coming at you. And the worst Germanys, the frustrating ones, and the ones that you see way too many of are the ones that have like four centers, five centers, and they're all crammed right into the spaces that are feeding. You know, in other words, if you're a four center Germany, you've got your three home centers plus Denmark or something. And all you're doing is just putting pieces in Kiel, Munich, Berlin, and Denmark to just try and preserve Kiel, Munich. Yeah. And then even if you build, sometimes you don't even have a space to build it because I feel like that happens to Germany more than it happens to any other country. And it's not even close.
Yeah, it's not fun. But, you know, now that I think about it, I feel like I've been given advice on how to play Germany.
A little healing.
Yeah, I feel like I should ask somebody who knows a little bit more than I do. I think we need, there are rules. I can talk about a triple, but other than that, like, how do you win with this country?
Yeah, I don't really
know. Definitely, I'm the last person on the planet to go, how would you win with this country?
Oh, well, here's what you do.
Yeah, Matt knows, probably.
You
know, I mean,
you think Matt knows?
I don't think anybody
knows.
Yeah, Matt is a purveyor of secrets of diplomacy. He's like the mysterious, magical leprechaun of diplomacy. He knows all kinds of obscure things. He's just a great guy to talk to about any diplomacy subject.
He's like sort of tome of knowledge. Just like, here I have. You expect him to have like sparkles coming
right,
up,
exactly.
A big giant book and some beakers bubbling with dry.
Exactly. He's sort of a mad scientist of the game, and doesn't matter how obscure the subject, we can talk to him about it. And so hopefully this podcast won't end up 9 hours long, but I can't rule that out.
No, it's not ruling out, because I mean, if it's 9 hours long, we're going to learn a lot.
That's also true.
Well, Matt Shields.
Yeah.
Let's get him on the phone. Let's talk to him about Germany, and let's find like some sort of cauldron like recipe.
Solo maybe.
Or a beer.
He'll be joining us right after this. Joining us now in our never-ending parade of former Grand Prix winners, we have the great Matt Shields, winner of the 2000 Grand Prix, was it?
That's
Matt?
Correct, 2000 Grand Prix. Almost 11 years ago now.
Almost 11 years, that's all right. Well, you're newer at it than some of the other ones we've had. So someday we'll get someone who's won the Grand Prix this decade on.
At least it's in this century. I mean, that's what I'm excited about.
He's also won a bunch of other tournaments and is really active
he's helped organize a lot of tournaments. He does a lot of hobby organizing stuff. He's just an all around go-getter, doer.
Go-getter. He's also like a professional at getting those like weird awards that no one else wants, but the weird awards at places like, hey, this guy got his ass kicked award, or like, hey, this guy looks like a sandcastle, you know, things like that.
I don't think they're going to believe us that he's actually online if we keep talking. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, Nathan. Hi, Eric. Well, you guys, for a minute there, I thought you were going to build up my ego, but
I took care of that.
You took care. Yeah, no, thank
trying.
You.
He was trying.
I was getting worried there.
You're really good at diplomacy, Matt.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I do keep playing over and over. So,
joining us via Skype from Portland, Oregon, I should say.
Oh yes, yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. Where do we start?
Well, there's a lot of questions I have for Matt. Yeah. I mean, some of them involve Germany.
Yeah.
Some of them.
I heard this is the Germany show.
We did.
All right.
Thanks for making it sound like we never talked to you beforehand. Like we just maybe prank called you and hoped you'd stay on the phone with us for a while. That's cool.
How about tell us a little about your story? How about you? How you got into tournament diplomacy? Sort of what your arc has been, and how you've gotten more involved as time's gone by. Start there.
Sure. I actually got into tournament diplomacy just because I was looking for an actual opportunity to play face-to-face diplomacy at all. I started playing when I was in college, and I was stuck with mostly email because I was in Fairbanks, Alaska, which did not have as big of a diplomacy community as you might think.
I find that incredibly surprising.
Yeah. So I moved back down to Oregon in, I think it was 1999, and almost immediately, I think my first tournament was up in Seattle at Dragonflight that year, and I didn't know anybody who was up there. I just kind of bought a train ticket, went up there, and I heard there was a diplomacy tournament, and I didn't really know anybody down here who played. And
okay,
that was the first one, and almost immediately I was hooked on it. By that next spring, I was driving halfway across the country for tournaments. And,
to Denver,
for example.
Less than a year later, I was meeting strangers that I didn't know on international ferry terminals and driving them across time zones.
Right.
And flipping your car in the snow.
The rest is history. Well, that's a
different year.
Yeah, that's a different show. But
I was on.
You can do that one sometime too.
Yeah.
Oh, good. The pilgrimage to Denver. That's fun. Well, and you've been, what is that, 12 years now?
Yeah, it's been a while now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think 99 was my first tournament. I've gone to at least a couple every year since then. Some of those early years were a fuller schedule than some of the more recent years have been, but I try to still do a couple, three every year.
And at some point you got a little more into the organization side of things as well.
Yeah, that took a little bit longer. The Portland hobby has sort of, gone up and down over the years as most places do.
Yep.
There was someone else shortly after I started, there was actually someone who managed to get a fairly decent Portland hobby going for a while, and I didn't really have to do anything organizationally. There were always other people who were taking care of all that. And then slowly over the years, as some people transitioned out and other people transitioned in, I ended up in a position where I was a little more active in the local hobby down here. And we ran DIPCON, I think it was in 2004, and that was real successful. And that was sort of took off from there after that.
Yep. And you end up as tournament director a lot at these things. You always somehow get drafted into that.
That might be my fault.
It's not just you. Yeah.
Do you want
to talk a little bit about, in case people don't know what the job of a tournament director is?
Sure. Yeah, no, we can talk about that.
Okay.
And I guess I should maybe break this down, because there's really a couple of different jobs that I think of as being discrete jobs when you're putting together a diplomacy tournament. Very often they get done by the same person, but they're really very different. One of those jobs is really the organizational piece of, finding a venue and figuring out how we're, going to get things together logistically. And then, of course, the hardest task, getting people to actually show up for the thing, which is usually, a matter of berating people over email for months leading up to an event, which I'm not, as good at as some of the other people on this call. But but then once the actual event starts, really the tournament director's job doesn't really get started until the day of the event, because that's all just about managing the actual tournament and, making sure everybody's in the place they're supposed to be. I mean, it's almost like, being a stage manager or something,
right?
Just making sure everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing and dealing with problems that come up at the last minute. you know, because hopefully everyone else is actually playing a game at that point. So, I've enjoyed doing that also, you know. Honestly, there was a dry spell in there in the middle for a while when I was probably not as successful playing as I like to be. So I think for a little while in there, I actually enjoyed the break of still staying in the hobby and staying active. But I didn't actually miss maybe this weekend. I'm not going to push pieces around. I'm just going to hang out here and do other stuff. And that was fun for me.
So as a tournament director, you're sort of expected to play only if needed to make a multiple of 7 or something, right?
That's usually the theory. And honestly, if you have any choice in the matter at all, it's best not to. I would go to great lengths to avoid actually playing. Gotcha. You know, in a small event, you usually have no choice because things never quite come out the way you want. But in a bigger event, you know, you've usually got other volunteers and people who will say, yeah, I'm glad to play, but I'll sit out if I have to.
And in any event, you never keep your own score, anything that you happen to do while you're on those boards.
You really can't. I mean, there's a couple issues with that. One is, even when you're playing the game, you know, you're still responsible for everything else that's going on in the room. So it's actually kind of hard to focus on actually playing the game like you normally would. You know, second off, and maybe this is just me, I always actually feel a little self-conscious and awkward when I'm playing because it's kind of like, oh God, you know, what am I supposed to do here? You know, if I do too well, like, you know, piss anybody off. And, you know, honestly, my biggest concern is usually just making sure everybody has a good time. So it's, you know, it's a little fishy. When we ran the World Championships back in 2007, one of the things that weekend, just one of the minor things that I was really happy about that weekend was that I never actually had to play a game. Mm-hmm. And I was like, 5 or 6 rounds. I forget how long it was now. I was like,
Do you think I did 5 rounds for that? I only did 4.
I think it was.
It felt like
it was
3 weeks.
6.
No, it was only 4.
I don't know. We'll check the inner tubes and see what it says. Yeah.
I'm sure I got talked down to 4.
No, you're not right about that.
I don't think so. I think it was at least 5. We'll compromise and call it 5.
Anyway, moving.
Yeah,
on.
But no, I was absolutely thrilled about that not having to play because 1, I couldn't handle it, but you know, 2, it was like, no, it was just. Felt so much better about the whole experience, not getting stuck in that position of, oh, geez, do I make 6 guys sit down or make somebody play on 2 boards at once or, you know, find some way to make the numbers come out. So,
And the tournament director's job is to make sure all that stuff gets balanced out. You also do all the scorekeeping and all the timing if necessary. And so it's a lot of work, but it's
figure out awards and all sorts of stuff.
But playing on boards with Nathan is also a lot of work. And so,
different kind of work.
There's a larger emotional burden in one of those.
Exactly.
But no, actually, I kind of enjoy that sort of stuff. So I don't mind, you know, taking a weekend off here and doing that.
You go to a lot of the European, well, you've gone to a few of the European events at least, right?
I've gone to a couple in recent years. I've been fortunate enough to do that a little bit, you know, not as often as I would like, of course, but I did make it to The Hague this past summer where they ran a very good little event. I never seem to do very well at any of those tournaments, but they're always a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's something about playing in Europe. I don't know what it is.
No, we should be nice to our potential European listeners.
I hear that there are Americans who go over there and do well. I don't know these people.
I hear there's Canadians that go over there and do well. I don't know if there's Americans.
Yeah.
North Americans.
Yeah.
North Americans. It's true. So we've talked a little bit. So you have a lot of hats. You've done your duties as initially a player. You've gone the tournament director route. You've gone sort of out there as a spokesman for, I don't know, our great nation here.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about playing. And in these days, now in all your jaded experience, what's it like to play now? And I'm going to follow this up with a secondary question once you finish.
Wow, you don't start with softball questions here.
No, we were done with those.
Okay, those were the okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly really different. When I sit down now. I guess the biggest difference, if I had to point to one thing, I guess the biggest difference is it's not overwhelming to have to, you know, sit down and think about maybe the details of, you know, okay, what do I do? I'm Russia. This guy's Turkey. You know, thinking about the bits and pieces moving on board. And instead, you have the luxury, at least I feel like I have the luxury of being able to just look at the other people sitting at that table and try to think about what are these guys about? What are these guys trying to do? And not have to focus, you know, the mental energy on actually, you know, messing around with the tactics. Not necessarily because that's not important and because I'm not going to have to think about that, but more just because I feel confident that, you know, if I make a mistake with the little stuff right now, I can clean that up.
Right.
But the bigger issue is, you know, if I make a mistake in building relationships with other players, that you might not be able to fix in 1902 or 1903. Whereas, you know, if I misorder something or I make a bad move, I can, you know, hopefully think myself out of that hole.
Yeah, I sort of think of you as a person that is kind of willing to try anything, and you base it more on. I've played a few games with you, and I feel like I see you as a person who is able to kind of is always willing to try different things, and sometimes you won't even want to do the simple things just because, oh, that's boring, I've done that one before. Is that sort of your style, would you say? Like,
That probably is a little bit of my style. It's certainly a reputation that I've developed, and it's I suppose it's probably a reputation that I deserve. I do think that's fun. I mean, I do think, you know, one of the interesting things about the game, just in general about diplomacy, is there's really no limit to the number of things you can do. I mean, if you actually have a couple of players that are really dedicated to trying something unusual, trying a different kind of opening, trying an alliance structure that maybe you don't see very often, or it's just really hard to pull off. If you've got a couple players that are dedicated to doing that, you can do almost anything in diplomacy, which is why, you know, you can play 100 games, you can play 1,000 games, and you really never play the same game twice.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's true. It's certainly a great way to, you know, learn, I think, just, and maybe that's actually one, you know, if we want to step back for a second and just talk about pitfalls, you know, that newer players get into sometimes. I think one pitfall you can get into is being afraid to try something a little different, because, you know, when you haven't played a whole lot of games, and maybe especially if you don't get the opportunity to play a whole lot of games.
Right.
Every game is kind of precious in the sense that I don't want to waste this. You know, I drove all the way across town to be here. I'm going to sit here for 6 hours. You know, playing this game. Do I really want to, you know, screw that up because I decided to try, you know, opening Munich to Tyrolia today, which I'd never, you know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, if you're, you know, going to a tournament for the weekend and you're going to play 3 or 4 games for the weekend, then, you know, maybe you're in a position where you think you can do this again in a few months, you know, try something, one game, because that actually is a really good way to learn. Just try different things you've never tried before. Try to get other people to do stuff you've never seen before. And it's an excellent way to learn about tactics. It's an excellent way to improve your diplomacy skills, because it puts you in a position where you really have to trust somebody and you really have to work with somebody.
Well, and
I'm all in favor of, you know, trying new things.
Well, it also works really well in a game where there's a lot of traditional openings and a lot of traditional sort of things you're supposed to do. There's a lot of focus on, especially if you're just learning the game, there's a lot of focus on, oh, you kind of need to do it this way. You kind of need to do it this way if you're going to be successful. And that works in the small sense that if you do otherwise, you really have to have the equipment and the tools to follow up with it. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you could really, really screw yourself. So,
absolutely.
You know, you need to be in a level that you can make it work. But at the same time, the reason that the novel approaches sometimes works is because we're operating in these sort of like, well, you're supposed to do it this way construct.
And, you know, that is, you know, the rare occasions when you can pull that off. I'm actually really glad you said that. The rare occasions when you can actually pull it off and do something that no one has seen before, right, or at least the guys you're playing haven't seen before, and your ally does what he's supposed to do, and no one gets, you know, weaselly and, you know, stabs too soon. Those are the games that are actually kind of epic, and that like 5 years later, you'll still be thinking back about the game and laughing about it because you and somebody else actually pulled off something that no one had seen before.
Yeah,
and
definitely
didn't see coming.
Definitely.
And you also often, when you pull it off, I mean, you will get often really, really good results from games like that.
Because it's just it's outside that mold. And I think I've tried to play at those games with you. It might have worked out once.
No,
it I don't know. I think it's worked out before, but I'm a big fan of that.
I guess I have one corollary that I would also add to this entire conversation, which is that
I feel like when I'm at tournaments and Matt's playing and I walk by his board, he'll have like four centers and none of them will be bordering each other. and like the pieces will just be all over. And he's always fine. Like ordinarily that's a sign that something's gone terribly wrong. But I feel like you're particularly good at just kind of getting your butt kicked early on and just going and doing interesting things and not really caring whether you're growing and then ending up with good results anyway. Do you have any secret formula for that or is it just,
you know, I guess before I answer that question,
yeah,
I should clarify that tactically getting your butt kicked early is not really that great of an opening strategy.
Right.
You know, it's like a lot of things. Sometimes it works, but I think the biggest thing in this, actually, this is something else I think that not necessarily newer players, but players who haven't played in a tournament environment very often. I think a lot of times if things go badly early, you know, they try something in 1901, 1902, and the guy they thought they were working with them turns out he was really never on their side to begin with, and they don't really have an ally, and they're, you know, sitting there at three or four in a bad position. A lot of players kind of don't know what to do.
Yeah.
At that point, they just get stuck. You know, maybe you're Italy and you lost Venice and you're sitting there with three centers and, you know, no one really wants to talk to you. Nobody wants to work with you. What do you
right.
do at that
point? And so you sit at the table and you don't talk to anybody and you sort of just wait to die.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I guarantee if that's what's happening, you know, if the other six players are all going off in their hybrid conversations and they're scheming and you're not talking to anybody, then yeah, you're definitely mm-hmm. waiting to die, and maybe it'll happen sooner, and maybe it'll happen later, and it actually sometimes happens much later, simply because you're irrelevant.
Yeah,
you take yourself out of the game. Your existence doesn't matter. You're actually so irrelevant that we don't even need to bother killing you right now.
Worst feeling ever in diplomacy.
Right, and so part of it. I mean, so there's a couple things. There's like actually a couple things I would say to players who are in that position. One of them is simply, you know, don't stop talking to people.
Yep.
You know, no matter how badly things are going, go out and keep talking to people. And if you can make yourself do it, especially, you know, go talk to the guy who like is killing you.
Right.
Not even necessarily, you know, from the angle of trying to talk him out of it or trying to say, hey, give me back the stuff you took or anything like that. Just try to get this person to involve you in some way. Try to find something useful that you can do where they basically are willing to decide that, okay, I'm probably still going to kill this guy later, but right now he's actually more useful to me alive than dead. I mean, try to find a way to keep yourself in the game. You know, if you take yourself out of the game and you're not giving anybody a reason to work with you, you're not giving anybody a reason to, you know, think of you as, you know, somebody who still matters, then you're definitely going to die. If you can keep yourself around long enough, then, you know, sometimes things break in your favor. You know, sometimes that guy who stabbed you and took a couple dots off of you earlier, maybe he's going to get in trouble down the road,
right,
you know, from the other side, and that'll give you a chance to, you know, grab a center back or something. And, you know, you don't know. And half the time, it doesn't work out. Half the time, you still die. It doesn't change anything.
But you were going to die anyway.
You were going to die anyway, right?
Yeah, but you're giving yourself that chance.
Mm-hmm. You're also giving yourself the opportunity to, like, just practice diploming with people that are, like, just having that conversation, there's value there to like, oh, what's it like to talk to somebody who wants to take all of my dots and how can I try and convince them? Like there's something to that. And only doing it over and over again, are you going to get any good at it?
Yeah. And there's the fun factor too. There's the,
oh yeah. What do you got to lose?
And every once in a while you just go and hatch a zany scheme and actually talk somebody into something and it works out well for you. So yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, and the other thing to think about is that one of the advantages of, you know, there aren't very many advantages to being at, you know, one or two or three centers, but one of the advantages of being really small like that is that you're not particularly a threat to anybody, and players who maybe otherwise would not have been real keen on working with you. Today they might say, okay, you know what, I'm going to work with this guy because he's only got two centers. He really can't do anything to me. And those couple of units he has, they're actually in a useful position. I mean, one of the really interesting things about diplomacy that takes years to, I think, fully incorporate into your thinking is that every single piece on the board really does make a difference.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one piece on the opposite side of the board moving, you know, left instead of right can totally change your game. And so when you're the guy who has that one piece, just because you don't see anything you can do that makes any difference to your position, doesn't mean there's not anybody else on the board who cares what your one piece does.
Right.
And so find that person, figure out who it is who cares what you're doing, figure it out what they want you to do, and see if you can find a way to make that work. See if you can find a way to spin that into something. And, you know, sometimes you can.
So you're, and I think that's a really great thing that to just keep in mind, and some things that are a little bit more advanced. So, and when you're talking to someone that you've sort of figured out has only played a couple of games, I mean, how do you explain these sort of really complex topics to them? I mean, I find that it's not my best strength to be able to talk to people like that. So what do you do? Cause I, my sense is, and maybe Eric has a different opinion, but my sense is you're pretty good at this particular thing, talking to new players.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I have a couple thoughts on that. I mean, one is don't try to feed new players too much information all at once. I mean, there's a lot of context mm-hmm. to playing diplomacy, and there's a lot of times when, you know, if you haven't played this enough, you really have to sort of internalize certain lessons yourself just by, you know, getting beat over the head. You know, there are things that sometimes seem like, oh yeah, this would be a really good plan. It would work really well. And it's not until you try this a couple times and discover that, no, this never works, that you fully internalize that. But as far as the really basic stuff, like just reminding people, hey, what you're doing matters, you know, these pieces over here, that you're just letting them sit here. You know, like for example, one thing you see new players do a lot is, you know, they might have a piece or two that's kind of off the side. They're not really doing anything with because they're afraid to move it or they're afraid to, you know, upset somebody. You know, go and talk to them about some of these details and just remind them that, hey, you know, what you're doing over here, even if it doesn't make a difference to you, it may make a difference to somebody else, and, you know, try to explain to them how they can use that to their benefit. But I don't think you can feed them too much of that at the same time. I mean, you have to,
right,
you know, sort of show them, I guess. Maybe that's the simplest answer, is that, you know, don't try to just tell them stuff. Try to actually show them, you know, through your play and through, you know, suggestions you make to them, why the things they're doing make a difference. But I don't know. I mean, it's like any game or like anything else, you know, in life. I mean, unless you have a certain amount of context, it's really hard to understand, you know, what are otherwise, you know, fairly complicated concepts. In diplomacy, it's not, I mean, the rules may be simple, but there's a lot going on behind the scenes that's not maybe obvious if you're an outside observer or even if you're playing but haven't played a whole lot. There's a lot going on that is hard to understand and it's hard to articulate. And so that's just, you know, that's part of learning the game.
Dang, man, I don't want to talk about Germany. I want to just keep going with this stuff.
Yeah,
this is much more interesting.
Well, I don't know.
All right, I got one.
Germany's fun too, though.
I've got one more, then we'll go to Germany.
Okay.
Do you approach when you're at a tournament versus when you're at a house game in terms of, like, assuming that your main goal is to actually do well at that game or at that tournament, do you approach it any differently?
Important context. I do approach it very differently. And there's a few things that are different, actually. In one game, if I'm just playing a single game, you know, in a house game, and I'm just, you know, there to have fun, but I'm also, you know, trying to win the game or trying to do really well. In some ways, I think I actually probably play a little more conservatively. And I know that sounds counterintuitive. But, you know, if I'm just playing this one game this weekend, I've only got the one game. You know, I don't have a do-over tomorrow morning. I don't have maybe some larger goal that's a little bit outside of this one game that I'm playing for. It's just this one game. And I'm likely to, you know, try things that I've tried before. I'm likely to try to, you know, do things that I think I know are going to work and maybe not take a whole lot of risks. With one caveat, and that's that sometimes I will use house games as sort of experiments. That, you know, maybe I have this idea in the back of my head that I want to test this out in an environment that doesn't really matter. But again, that's kind of stepping back from the idea that I'm actually here to do well, because if that's what I'm doing, I'm not really coming to this house game with the intention of trying to win the game or trying to do well. I'm actually going there with some other goal.
Right. Like recruiting new players for
like recruiting new players. And sometimes that's also a thing. Mm-hmm. And actually I will throw that out there, even though it has nothing to do with your question. If you are somebody who's, you know, trying to build up a little bit of a diplomacy hobby in your area, if you're, you know, maybe you're somebody who you've played a halfway decent amount, you know, you've played 20 or 30 games, but maybe it's mostly online, you have a hard time getting seven guys together, and you're thinking, hey, I should try to get a game together at my house or my dorm room or, you know, wherever with some guys from work. Your goal, you know, try to remind yourself that for that one day, you know, your goal is not to go play the best diplomacy game you can play. Your goal that day is to be a host, and your goal that day is to sucker these guys into coming back and playing again. And maybe that's the diplomacy game you're playing. You know, those six guys are moving pieces around on the board. You know, what your goal is to convince these guys that what they want to do is actually come back and play diplomacy with you again.
Right.
So remember,
and maybe that. Bring their friends.
Yeah. And even better, bring their friends. Yeah. But as far as, so that's, you know, house games. Tournament games to me are very different. And, you know, we could easily spend a whole show talking about some of the psychological differences between how different people play at tournaments, because there certainly are people who go to tournaments who, for various reasons, try to treat it exactly like a house game. And they really try to treat it like, you know, two or three or four totally independent games that have no relationship to each other. They try to, you know, not think about what happened yesterday. They try to not think about, you know, is there another game tonight? And that's, I think that's valid. I don't think there's anything wrong with people doing that, but that's definitely the opposite of how I play.
Right.
You know, when I get to the tournament, I'm definitely thinking about who are the other players here, who did well last round. You know, if I'm really on the ball, I'm thinking about what countries people played yesterday and what countries they might draw, you know, in future games. And I will make a lot of my decisions about, you know, who I ally with one game, for example, based on things like how these people do yesterday.
Yeah.
Which incidentally, to go back to your earlier question, is one of the reasons I hate playing tournaments that I run.
Right.
Is because when I go to a tournament, I'm never just playing the game. I mean, if you ask somebody about the concept of a TD playing the game, they're usually going to say, hey, as long as he's just playing the game, I've got no problem with that, because the theory is they're just going to sit down, they're going to do whatever's in the best interest of their country. For me, I'm rarely doing that even when I am a player. I'm still thinking about things like, Nathan did really well in the first round, I need to find a way to screw him.
Yeah.
And also, it would be nice if I got some dots for myself along the way.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's, you know, honestly, sometimes getting yourself dots isn't even the first priority. Sometimes it's second priority. Sometimes, you know, what happened yesterday actually is more important. And that's another thing, to go back to your question about, you know, things to do when you're doing badly. And it's hard to generalize, but think about things like, you know, if you did really well yesterday and you know, you know, there's like these five guys that are ahead of you in the standings, or you think there's about that many guys ahead of you, you know, think about that sort of stuff. Think about what kind of results you want.
Try and ruin their day. Curve. Yeah, for sure.
Maybe it's about, but it's different though. Sometimes it's about flattening out the curve. I mean, sometimes you're on a board and there's like two or three guys who you think are maybe already ahead of you, and you know you're probably going to get eliminated from the draw, or at least get a pretty crappy result. You know, sometimes your goal might be, I want everyone's score to suck. You know, sometimes you're going to say, my goal is to drive this game into a five-way draw where nobody gets any meaningful number of points at all because, hey, I'm not getting any points. You know, I see no reason for anybody else to get any decent points. On the other hand, sometimes what you want is maybe you're doing halfway decently and it's the last round and there's one guy in the tournament who's been getting hammered all week and he's not going to catch you no matter what happens. So basically, hey, you know, I'm just going to feed this guy dots.
Sure.
Because I don't care. I'm going to take all of Eric's dots and give them to this dude. I don't care if I get them, because basically I'm giving points to this guy. I'm just throwing him in a hole.
And he's having a great time.
Yeah, and he's having a great time, and he's more than happy to work with me, you know, taking somebody else's dots.
Yeah, and as an added bonus, he's had a terrible tournament and gets to walk away
with
the
results. Yeah, and that's fun, too.
And it's Eric, so, I mean, it's fun for everybody.
Even better. No, and so, you know, it's hard to generalize because it really depends on what's your situation, you know, where are you relative to other players in the tournament, who's on your board, and how have they been doing, and so the details of what you actually want to do are going to vary wildly, you know, from one game to another game. But the thing to remember is, if you're actually playing the tournament and you're actually sort of trying to improve your standing in the overall event, even if you know you're going to get eliminated, you actually probably do have an opinion about what happens on this board after you die.
Right.
And so before you do die, you know, the one thing you can do is try to make sure that when you go, this board is set up in a way that it's likely to go in your favor.
Yeah. And that's part of that whole flexibility we were talking about, being willing to do unusual things and try unusual alliances, that can really pay off at tournaments, particularly.
Sure.
You can go, well, we hate the Italy-Turkey alliance. It's just a god-awful alliance. But you might sit down at the board at the beginning and just look at it and go, man, for all of these tournament reasons, Turkey would probably be my best ally this game. And then you just have to do impractical things sometimes for that reason.
Absolutely, yeah. Or at least, and even if you're not, I mean, even if you are working with the people you're competing with, you're at least being conscious of it. And so you're aware. And even if you, and I guess this is one other thing, even if you don't care that much, even if you're not somebody who necessarily is going to make your decisions based on how it affects the overall standing, at least remember that the guy you're allying with might be one of the people who does that. And he might be somebody who's going to sit down at the board and he's going to say, oh, I need to kill Matt.
Yep.
You know, the most, I will give you the most perfect archetypal example of this I ever saw was there was a tournament. You probably mentioned it before. There was a tournament in Seattle. It used to be run that was called Dragonflight. They ran for I don't even know how long. That was actually the first tournament I went to was Dragonflight in 1999. And I went to that thing every year for about 10 years. Unfortunately, it went away. But one year, and I do not recall what year this was, 5 or 6 years ago, probably. The scoring system was such that there was a top board. And so, the top seven people after however many rounds it was made it to the top board. And once you're on the top board, basically it wasn't just like a winner take all kind of system. Like some places where there's a top board, whoever wins the top board wins the tournament and that's all there is to it. It wasn't exactly like that. It was a heavily draw based system where everybody in the draw gets the same number of points. And we're going to add those points to however many points you had coming in here, which meant the guy who was in first place when that game started, if he's in the draw, he wins the tournament.
The guy who's
in second place, if he's in the draw, he wins the tournament as long as the guy in first place dies.
Oh, my God. That sounds like a nightmare board.
The guy in third place wins as long as he kills one and two. Anybody want to take any guesses on what happened in that game?
The guy in seventh place won.
The guy in seventh place soloed the board. Actually, the woman in seventh place soloed the board.
Oh, my God.
And it was, it was a player named Mary Cooner, who was a halfway decent player, I always thought. And
she still
that
plays.
Was what happened, because it was basically like everybody's trying to kill the person on their right, and she was the person at the far left end of the line. No one wanted to kill her, because it's not in anyone's interest to kill her. And so even when she's at 16, there are still guys at 3 who are trying to kill the guy at 4.
I wasn't at that tournament. That was ever. I think it was 2006.
I was there. I forgot all.
It was somewhere in there. But that was a classic example of people understood what the system was.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this particular system had some perverse consequences that probably hadn't been thought through.
Yeah, which
before it was implemented.
Which I think we could probably do a whole other podcast about.
We could also
if people are interested in.
we'll have a scoring system pod. I mean, definitely will have. We'll have a whole episode on scoring system because there's just a lot there.
And no one will listen.
Oh no, I think a lot of people will listen. Well, I think everyone. It's one of those things that everybody has an opinion on a scoring system.
Hey, listeners, write in. Is that at all interesting to you? Or just the three of us nerds?
Yeah, it's probably a scoring system, nerds. So when you were on that board, that terrible board you're just talking about, who was Germany? That's my transition.
God, I don't remember.
Did they do well?
No.
Okay, so how does Germany do well then?
Nice. Think. Oh, nice. That's nice. Zuri does well by not being on that board. That's a good place to start.
Or a lot of boards, really.
Well, I think it depends a little bit. Not to put too much of a disclaimer on this, but it depends a little bit on what you mean by doing well.
Yeah.
Really. It's our job to put impossible questions on.
If it means getting to 18 dots, we're going to assume your goal is to win here because that's why we play.
Yeah.
If your goal is getting to 18 dots, then I actually think that, and this is going to sound contrary to what I just said a minute ago, but I think your options are actually a little bit narrower than they otherwise would be. It's not that hard. Well, Germany can get to, 7, 8, 9 dots if they're having a good game a lot of different ways. I mean, there's, one of the things about being in the middle of the war is there's a lot of dots in all directions around you. And so there's a lot of different things you can take to get up to some middle and number of centers. And you can survive at that kind of a level and have a perfectly happy result. You know, you might be the biggest guy on the board, you might not be the biggest guy on the board, but you can get to a respectable size and feel good about it. But if your goal is to actually get to 18 centers, at least in my experience, there's only so many ways you can do that, because what the other players do and how you allow them to grow is going to foreclose a lot of options. You know, one of the things, for example, that you see when Germany and England are working together, and if they're both doing really well, is you see these games where Germany just builds a million armies, you know, plows into Russia, they knock France down a few centers, and then there's some German armies moving in on Austria. And you see England up at the top, and maybe they've got more fleets than they know what to do with. And they're up in St. Petersburg, and they're coming around Spain, and, you know, that whole side of the board is Germany, England. And they're doing good, and they're both at, you know, 7, 8, 9, however many centers. And they may well be the two guys, the two biggest powers on the board, and the game may end that way. But if you're Germany, and you're in that position, and, you know, your real goal wasn't to get to 8 or 9 centers, your real goal was to get to 18, what do you do?
Right.
And I think the answer is nothing, because you've kind of foreclosed the option of realistically getting 18 already. And so, I don't know, and I don't know if that's been your experience too, but it just seems like...
Oh, that's much better than I ever do as Germany.
Yeah. You know, and it was one of the things one of you said off the air earlier was that when you were reviewing records, you said I had more best countries as Germany than any other country. And initially, yeah. I'm like, that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. Because I think Germany, in a lot of ways, is probably my least favorite country to play.
Woot.
Yay but for us.
Also, I think part of the reason that it might be that I still kind of do okay with it is because it probably, being Germany, probably forecloses some of my natural tendencies to do some of the crazy stuff.
Right, you can't have any fun.
Wasn't that smart of an idea in the first place? And so I think it probably has forced me to play a little bit more disciplined when I'm Germany than I would if I was Italy or if I was, you know, yeah. God forbid, Russia or Turkey. When, yeah.
I said that too, or early on in this. Yeah. I said that there's not really all that many like gambits, all that many like all in, all or nothing, just crazy.
There are and there aren't. I mean, one of the things I think that's hard about Germany, if you're a newer player, is, you know, every country technically has a million different things they can do.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're England, you're not going to open Edinburgh to Clyde, because that's pretty obviously crazy, even if you haven't played the game. Most countries, even countries like Italy and Austria, which we think of as probably being weaker or more difficult powers than Germany, even with those countries, there's not that many openings that aren't pretty clearly dumb. I mean, really, you know, if you're Austria, you're going to go to Serbia. You're probably going to send that fleet to Albania. Sometimes you'll hold it, but, you know, there's only a couple different things you're going to do with that. That army in Vienna, it's either going to go to Glacier, it's going to go to Budapest. You know, once in a while you'll do something else, but really there's only, you know, 6 or 7 different things you might actually do.
Right.
Maybe this will actually work. And so you see people open to Prussia and Silesia, and you see people send that fleet in Kiel to the Baltic. And, you know, you see guys send an army in Munich down to Tyrolia or over to Bohemia. And some of these moves I actually think are kind of terrible moves in all but extreme cases, but they're just plausible enough that people are willing to actually do them.
Right. We were talking about that earlier.
That gets people in trouble when you're playing Germany.
That's a really good point. I didn't think of it that way.
I was just at a tournament earlier this year where the German player actually opened. He opened Munich to Silesia. He opened Berlin to Prussia. And I think the fleet went to Denmark. I forget. And it's terrible. I was, I think, France or England. And so I was fine with him doing this. And I probably encouraged it. But I don't think I've ever seen that work, but it's just plausible enough that you can sort of see a light at the end of the tunnel that, well, maybe if my allies are irrationally generous, this will work out for me.
That's true. I guess technically he has like 5 of the 6 powers are his neighbors.
Yeah.
And so if.
Yeah. If they can all just pick one as a target,
like, yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, Germany can send 2 units in a lot of different directions.
That's a good point.
But I think, but that flexibility, I think, can really get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, and this may be different from your experience. I know that, you know, one of the discussions with Germany that you always inevitably get into pretty quickly is, you know, what do you do about Sweden?
Right.
And, you know, is it just a given that you bounce Russia every time, or is it not? And I've actually gone back and forth on that. I mean, like a lot of players, I started out always bouncing. Well, maybe not, I shouldn't say always bouncing, but, you know, bouncing the Russian player on screen more frequently than I actually should, probably. Just as kind of a knee-jerk, hey, it's another player, and I don't really want them that close to me, and I don't want them growing. And
sure.
And then, you know, as you, you know, have a little more experience, you eventually realize that it's actually a lot of times it's fine for Russia to do that. But as I've gotten to the point where I'm actually a little more focused on trying to get to 18 instead of just trying to get to 9, I'm actually starting to, I don't want to say rethink that position, because it very frequently is the correct thing to let Russia have that dot in 1901. But at the same time, it really feels to me like Germany's path through to success really just goes through Scandinavia.
Mm.
Those are the centers that you have to get probably more than anything else on the board. I mean, you're going to pick up Holland, but even more than Belgium, even more than, you know, Warsaw or Tatum out of France, it feels like Denmark, Sweden, Norway is where you have to go. And I say that only because if you just start counting, you can do without a lot of stuff, but there's no way you can do without those. And getting back to what I said a minute ago, once someone else takes that space, I mean, once Russia or England comes in, occupies that space, starts building a bunch of fleets, there's basically an option that's been foreclosed to you. Because if you're Germany, the last thing you want to do is have to build like 5 fleets, right? I mean, I think we know this. Germany's a land power. You have to mostly be building armies.
Yeah.
Which means if someone else gets up in there, if someone else builds a bunch of fleets and takes this, you're never getting rid of them.
You're not wrong
They're
about
just
that.
Just going to be there. And so one way or another, you have to make sure that doesn't happen. Now, sometimes you can make sure that doesn't happen by letting Russia take some of that stuff and these guys bounce each other out for a while and don't really accomplish anything. And that's fine. But what you can't let is for one person to just basically dominate that whole section of the board.
Right. And we were talking about Sweden earlier. Mostly our focus was, and I think it's in alignment with what you're saying, is make sure you have a good reason for bouncing. Just make sure that you've thought about it and there's a rationale behind it. Don't have a knee-jerk response.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the one thing I actually, I think I like doing the most, although I tend to not have very good luck convincing Russia of this, is basically telling Russia, you can't have Sweden, but you can have Norway. You know, by which I, of course, mean I'm going to let you have Sweden in 1901, but in 1902, we're putting you in Norway and I'm taking Sweden.
Yeah, which is a more stable long-term.
Which is a much more stable thing. I actually think it's extremely equitable. Yeah. And I think it's something that the Russian player should be fine with. Because really, most of the time, I mean, just getting that one center is a big deal to them.
Oh, yeah. And it's such a pain in their ass.
Yeah, it's a huge pain in the ass. Norway is a much more stable spot.
Right.
It puts them in a position where if they want to go after England, they can. And honestly, they can still go after Germany if that's what they want to do, you know, from that position. But for some reason, I've had very little success actually convincing Russian players of that. And I think it's just because once you're in Sweden as Russia, you know, your eyes get big and you start thinking, okay, now how do I take them both?
Well, right. And you also have, I mean, the only way that that works is you're committing to something to the north. And a lot of people have a problem doing that. I mean, it's a commitment. You got to have that extra pressure to make sure Sweden gets into Norway. And you know, some people want to use that army someplace else.
It seems to me that times that I've had long term peace with the Russian when I was the German, or even medium term peace, that's ended up being the arrangement one way or the other.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think you have.
Oh yeah, very frequently. Yeah. Very frequently it is. Yeah. Because if you're actually going to work with Russia in the long term, what you can't have is a situation where both of you are committed to like leaving a unit or two
right
up there staring at each other.
I mean, you don't want,
otherwise could be doing something productive.
You don't want that fleet to drop down to the Baltic any more than he wants to have to worry about Norway sitting a adverse unit on Norway threatening St. Pete. I mean, you both have an interest in getting out of that shit.
And England, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think England is the bigger problem for him, because if he's still in Sweden, that almost by definition means that England is in Norway, which means Russia, on the one hand, has to worry about England going to St. Pete. But on the other hand, he has to worry about me and England getting together and saying, why are we letting this guy keep Sweden?
Yep.
And one of us supporting him. I mean, it's just, it's not, Sweden is not that tenable of a spot for Russia.
No, it's terrible.
And I actually think that's interesting, because a lot of people, when you sort of talk to people about what's the natural distribution of supply centers, you know, as though there was such a thing, And, you know, you sort of say, okay, well, you know, Austria always takes Serbia and Turkey always takes Bulgaria and Italy always takes Tunis. And, you know, France always takes Spain and Portugal. And I think a lot of people will say Russia takes Sweden. And it's just thought of like that's kind of the natural state of affairs. And I really think it's more like Belgium, that after, you know, Belgium is sort of the archetypal spot where, you know, maybe it's German, maybe it's French, maybe it's English. Right. But after Belgium, I think probably Sweden is the next center where you say it's not really clear who gets this.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
Right, and I don't know.
Maybe something in the Balkans, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. And it depends.
No. Yeah, I think the thing about the Sweden move, and that there's a bunch of Russians out there that just, they're always going for the Swedens. And there was this clever guy who wrote this article who suggested that maybe dropping it down to the Baltic.
Four episodes of this show now, and you brought this up twice. I'm so proud of yourself for your article.
Well, I haven't thought about it in like 8 years.
tell me more about this guy.
No, he's his name's Eric Mead. And,
no, it's not.
Oh.
It's really not.
No, we can get off Sweden. It's a personal tick for me.
I think it's valid though, because my impression is you're one of these people who really really dislikes the bouncing Russia.
Well, I don't like that it's this knee jerk thing. I don't like that it's an inefficient use of forces. I mean, I can't come up with a better use of that Russian fleet. I mean, honestly,
but it's terrible.
It's agonizing that there's all this potential that's being wasted on like, oh, get to Sweden. Like, all you're doing is just saying, I'm going to park this thing in a place where I can build something someplace else and have it sit there. I mean, it just keeps the spot warm. It's not effective at all.
It keeps someone else from walking in. But yeah.
I know. I mean, it's ridiculous. So
no, and that's back to why I really think that the Norway is the better thing. Is to forget Sweden, let Germany have Sweden.
Yeah, exactly.
Let Russia have Norway. At least then you've got options and you can do something else with your life if you want to. But yeah, I mean, you have to do something with your pieces. I mean, that's one of the things you have to be doing.
Yeah,
most games is doing something with all of your pieces. You can't just have a piece that's sitting around doing nothing.
So it sounds like
there's something to do.
You start with Scandinavia. That's where you're on your solo track. You're starting with Scandinavia. Where are you going next? Let's say, like, for whatever reason, you've managed to get the pieces you want up there.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, and obviously, as with all things, it depends on what else is going on the board, because right. what else is happening makes a big difference.
You might not have started with Scandinavia.
For example, yeah.
Yeah.
I think going after France is, at least in my experience, usually the wrong decision.
Okay.
One of the things, even in 1901, I mean, and I think you made an analogous discussion of this, I think, in your England episode. I think there was a discussion about how, really, you know, France never actually goes to the English Channel. It just hardly ever actually happens. The converse of that is that France is always paranoid about Germany going to Burgundy. And there's always this tension over, you know, what do we do in Burgundy? Are we going to bounce in Burgundy? And you see French players supporting themselves into Burgundy all the time. And how often do you actually see Germany open to Burgundy? You know, hardly ever, it seems like.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And so
Germans should probably do it more. Yeah. In fact,
well, no, I'm not sure they should. I mean, this is a maybe more than we want to get into. But what do you do? You know, even if I open a German, even if I open a Burgundy, and even if it works, what am I going to do now?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to walk into something, most likely. I mean, unless the French player is gambling and just gambles wrong,
right?
You know, he can cover everything very easily. And even if I have allies, even if I'm working with Italy. You know, Italy's not going to support me to Marseille. He's going to expect me to put him in there first. Even if I'm working with England, England's going to want help getting stuff on the mainland first. The only center that's sort of naturally German in a big anti-France move is Paris, which is going to be the last thing that's going to fall
Most
of the time. Well, other than like Spain and Portugal and stuff, you're never getting anyway. So for me, you know, the strong anti-French German opening, it just doesn't work that well.
Right.
I think it works for England, but I'm not convinced that it works that well for France. Now, you know, you may try to, you know, fight with France over Belgium or something, and that's fine. And if you sort of keep that, you know, contained a little bit, where however much you're fighting with France, we don't let it, you know, wreck each other's games. I think that's fine, you know, if it's just sort of that level. But I don't think, you know, seriously driving armies in there. Is that feasible? It's just, it's too hard to do, and it's too easy for France to just stick two armies there that are supporting each other and say, nah, nah, nah.
Yeah, you're not getting in. It seems like the only way that Germans ever actually make early progress against the French is if the French are too distracted trying to fight England, and you sort of slop your way into a couple of centers. Right. That he's just not doing a good enough job defending. Yeah.
Right. No, that'll happen. I mean, if you manage to get an army into Belgium early on, say, I mean, maybe, maybe you go to Ruhr as your opening move, and it just turns out everybody else is too busy doing other stuff and no one goes to Belgium and you walk in.
Exactly.
And that probably happens one game in four or something. Yeah. If France and England are really tied up, France may be more focused on dealing with England. He may be ticked off at England. He may just not care that much what you do. And you may be able to slip at a Picardy or slip at a Burgundy, and you may be able to grab a center that he's not focused on defending for whatever reason. But that's not really so much of an opening strategy as it's just, being smart and taking advantage of opportunities that spring up during the game.
Right.
I think as a strategy, if I'm looking for someone to go after, if I, manage to be successful in those early moves and go after Scandinavia and actually get that, and maybe now I'm sitting on seven centers, my next target usually is going to either be England or Russia, and it's just going to depend on what else is going on. Who's stronger and who's getting hammered from where. And start counting centers. I mean, you should be counting centers, 1902, 1903. I mean, if you get, you start with your three, and you pick up Belgium and Ruhr, and you pick up Scandinavia, and now you're sitting on eight. Those three Russian centers in the north, we'll set Sebastopol aside for a second, but those three Russian centers, St. Pete, Moscow, Warsaw, pretty much you're not going to get to 18 without getting all of those. Yeah,
those are in almost every German solo.
You basically don't see it. I mean, you can concoct situations where maybe you don't have Moscow or something, but that means you're taking something that's much harder to take, which means something weird has happened.
Right.
Again, you don't want to build a ton of fleets if you can avoid it, because once you take it in England, what are you going to do with them? So you're focused on armies. So again, Russia's just easier, to deal with.
Yep.
Ideally you've got France and England, fighting amongst each other and not putting too much pressure on you, and it lets you go that way. I think that would be my preference. If I really have the option. But you have to be open to going after England, and going after England probably means, again, working with France to some extent. I would rather work with France, have him help me just enough that we can take out England, than have to build enough fleets to go after England myself. Which again, I guess, gets me back to, I don't really like going after France early if I'm Germany, because what now? Even if I win, now what do I do? You see these Germans all the time who have, eight armies, and they're just stretched out on a line from Paris to, God knows where. And then England's all behind them. England is in a great position to stab Germany. Germany is in no position to stab England. And now what? All you can do at that point is just hope that England's on your side. But you're never going to drive far enough into Austria to be a threat to a solo. And if you were ever a threat, England would just start picking up dots behind you.
Yeah, I feel like those Austrian ones should be easier to get at when you're trying to solo as Germany. And for whatever reason, they just never are. Like, you get
Vienna. They're so hard.
Yeah.
They're so hard. I mean, going after Austria, again, I sort of feel like I'm, criticizing everything Germany can do. But going after Austria, again, early is a terrible trap.
Even late.
Late it's very difficult to do, but at least late there may be valid reasons, I've killed everyone else.
Right.
Now it's time to go.
The only people left alive.
Yeah.
It's something personal. But no, I mean, it's really, really hard. I mean, just, the positioning of the spaces relative to each other means that for the most part, those centers are easier to hold on to from the south than they are from the north.
Yep, exactly.
And you can get in there, and even if you get in there and you take, Vienna, for example, it's only one dot, and you're going to spend two or three units holding on to it.
Yeah.
And even then, you may not be able to get any farther than that, depending on what else is going on.
It's really hard. Well, for two reasons, we kind of have to wind this down now. The first reason is that we've already been talking like an hour, and we've made a truly epic podcast at this point. And the second reason is there seems to be some sort of odd, I'm going to say, calypso party elsewhere in my house, and it's getting increasingly rowdy. And I'm worried.
I think it's coming this way. It's a calypso cyclone.
I'm in the wrong place.
You're welcome to drive on up.
It's going to be awesome.
But now
I know how to win as Germany. I didn't know beforehand.
I didn't know.
We have to do one more, though.
We have to ask that question. We have one more question for you.
You have one more question you want to get into?
Matt has, a pretty great biggest mistake story. We've been asking people this question.
What's your biggest one?
Have you been asking everybody this question?
Most people.
I want to hear what everybody else says. I'll give you one.
Eddie Bresson simply told us that we'd asked the wrong question, proceeded to ask himself a better question, and then answer that one.
I believe that is true. Eddie factors into my story, too, eventually.
Oh, good. All right.
So I think when you open this whole segment up, you talked a little bit about this reputation that I guess I developed early on for wanting to try things that are a little bit different, a little unusual, and wanted to try something just to try it. And while I think that's great and I think it's good to do that, it certainly can get you in trouble. There was a tournament 3 or 4 years ago up in Seattle that I should have won and didn't win because I got myself in too much trouble basically trying to be cute. This was it was the top board at WAC 1 year, and it was this is one of the strongest boards I've ever played on. I think I was almost certainly the worst person on that board, and there were two or three guys who were just very, very good players. I was not playing Germany, unfortunately. I was playing Italy, and I think one of your earlier guests was Jim O'Kelly.
Yeah,
Jim was the Austrian to my Italy on this particular board. I got off to a very good start at Jim's expense. I wish I could recall the exact openings, and I don't, but essentially I took two centers in 1901 and took two centers in 1902, pretty much at Jim's expense. Opened the tire early and snagged something off him, and then went to him and apologized and said, "I'm sorry, we can still work together," and then took two more dots off him.
Oh.
And so at the end of 1902,
You're a mean man.
Yeah, I know. I felt bad about it, but Jim took it very well. So I was a seven and got off to a good start, and I'm feeling pretty good. But more importantly than the centers I had taken was what else is going on the board. The Turkish player was a guy named Jake Mannix. He was a pretty good player. Very good player, really. And he just plowed into Russia early on. I was having a pretty good go of it attacking Russia, so he's not really a problem right now. The French player had gotten attacked by both England and Germany, and so he's not really a hassle either. And so not only did I get off to a pretty good start in terms of grabbing a bunch of dots, but the only guy I'm fighting is at like one center. So I'm pushing east, and I'm putting a little bit of pressure on Turkey, and I'm making sure he's bottled up, and I'm making sure he can't hurt. And I pick up another center, and I get to eight. I pick up Serbia or Greece or something like that. And Russia's getting pounded on. He doesn't have time to hurt me. France is getting pounded on. He doesn't have time to hurt me. At some point, for lack of anything better to do, I slip a fleet over to the Western Med just to kind of see what's going on over there. Maybe I can get something out. Maybe I can put pressure on something. One of the greatest things about this position, and this is a luxury that you have very, very few times in diplomacy, and that I did have this game, was that however many units I had, I was able to bottle up Turkey and not have any threats from him, and I've still got like two more units just kind of hanging out that don't have anything to do. And it's a real luxury anytime you're in a position where you just have extra units, because you can just go, try something, go try to grab a center here or there, and if it doesn't work out, hey, I haven't lost anything. So I go over to the Mid-Atlantic, and I think I had an army that I probably got stranded in Africa, and I, scooted it over to North Africa, and then I went to the French player. And the French player was a guy named Jan Clouet, who's
actually
the French guy playing France.
Yeah.
As opposed to the French guy playing Russia, which was a guy named Cyril Savine, who's probably one of the best players in the world, honestly. The French guy playing France, and I just told him, hey, I'm just going to go to the Mid-Atlantic. I know you probably aren't in love with that, but you're getting pounded on. If I'm going to do anything to help you out, I've got to be in the Mid-Atlantic. And he said, fine. He wasn't happy about it, but he knew I was right in the sense that if I'm going to help him, I have to get there. And I'm sure he was perfectly aware of the fact that, if I attack him too, he's dead anyway. So he's got very little to lose. So I walk into the Mid-Atlantic, and I stick this extra army that I have in North Africa, I think. And this was in the fall. From this position, I'm at, eight centers or whatever it was. The thing I could have done, and the thing that one of you would have done, the thing that any one of your listeners who's, played more than one game would have done. In the spring, I could have convoyed to Portugal, and there was nothing that could bounce that. And if I did that, in the fall, I could have used that new army in Portugal and supported myself into France. And there's nothing he could have done about that. I mean, there was literally nothing he could do to stop me from taking these two units off. Instead,
I love it.
I'm getting so tense.
Jan, who is not only a very, very good player, but, you know, tactically, but reads the other players very well. I think I had played him before, but we hadn't played much. But despite the fact that we hadn't played, I'm positive that he knew who I was, and then he had talked to other people, and he had said, hey, tell me about this Matt guy, because there's, you know, other people on the board who'd played me a couple times. And I was attacking them, so they were probably more than happy to tell Jan how to kill me. Jan said, he comes up to me after inviting me to the Mid-Atlantic, and comes up to me and says, hey, I've got this great idea. If you move that fleet of yours up to the Irish Sea, which can't be bounced because England's doing other stuff, I'll go to the Mid-Atlantic and we can convoy you, that army, all the way up to Liverpool. And won't that be fun?
Won't that be fun that got
And
you,
it was just, it was too intriguing. And I said, oh yeah, let's do that. And of course, I mean, this works, of course. He of course, is completely sincere about this. It's not a setup in the sense that he's lying to me.
Want to go to the Mid-Atlantic, and he does want you to leave. That's true.
And he's more than, and he followed through on the whole thing. He was more than happy to actually do this thing, because this thing he's proposing is terrible for me and good for him. And so it turns out those are the kind of plans that your allies will follow through on. So he convoys me up there, and it's entirely successful in the sense that now I'm in Liverpool. And so I now have an army, and so those two units that I was telling you about earlier that were so valuable because I could do anything I wanted to with them. What I have basically done is chosen to strand those things in England.
On the other side of the board.
So where are we now? Turkey is still stuck in a box because the rest of my units are locking him up. I can't move because I've taken all of my extra units and crammed them into the corner. Russia's still mostly dead. Austria is still dead. France is still in a crappy position, even though he got rid of me. And I've just destroyed England's game because this, you know, jackass Italian has decided to go around the guy he can kill and win the game and instead hurt him. The game ended pretty quickly after that when it became obvious that Germany was just going to take everything because I had, you know, seen to that. A couple of little postscripts to that. The funniest thing about the whole thing, although I didn't understand this at the time, was that everyone else on the board, I think, to some extent was in on the joke in the sense that they realized this is Matt doing Matt's thing.
Right.
Except for me. I actually, before I made this move, I was talking to Jake, and you guys know the Turkish player Jake Maddox,
So
you probably imagine this. We walked up in negotiations, and the gist of the conversation was he asked me, so are you going to take Portugal? And I said, oh, no, I'm going to go to the IRC and convoy to Liverpool. And he got this look on his face, which I have to commend him for keeping a straight face when he's doing that. And his eyes got really big and he just was like, oh yeah. Okay. You know,
outstanding general.
I had just said the most absurd thing in the world to him. But of course, if he laughs at me or tells me that I'm an idiot, you know, the spell will be broken.
Right.
Right.
And I might actually do this asinine thing. So he has to, you know, like a good actor, pretend like the thing I have just told him is actually an excellent idea. And why, yes, you should do that. So anyway, that, you know, the game blew up and sort of, and it was fine. Everybody was happy. And the guy who won the tournament was an English player named Dan Lester, who's really good and, you know, probably has far more tournaments than I have. I talked to him about that later on, and he, you know, gave me his take on the game and basically, you know, reinforced what I had learned myself, which was that what Jan had done, and, you know, this I think is a lesson for everybody. What Jan had done is employ a tool that I think everybody should use, and that if you're a new player, it's really, really good to use, which is don't focus all of your, you know, mental energy on these pieces on the board and figuring out where they're going to go and figuring out what your opponents are going to do with them. Try to get inside your opponent's heads and figure out, what is this guy like? What is this person like to do? And figure out a way to exploit that. And that's what Jan had done. I mean, I have this great chocolate lab that's a great dog, but is really not very bright. And what Jan did is like what I do with the dog. When I just take a ball and chuck it over the hill. And the dog just goes off over the hill and, you know, we'll run into traffic for the ball. And so I promised you that the postscript to this involved Eddie.
Oh, yeah.
It did, because so sort of in the following weeks, I kind of replayed this thing in my head because I knew I had screwed this game up. I didn't quite understand what I had done. And I kind of figured it out that, oh, okay, I realize now that I actually have perhaps developed something of a reputation for trying screwball things that I shouldn't try. And so I went down to San Francisco for a tournament down there that Eddie's instrumental in running. And I was on a board with Eddie. I don't remember if it was the first round or the second round or when it was. And spring 01, he comes up to me to negotiate. And the first thing out of his mouth is, let's do something fun. What would be fun?
Oh.
Yeah. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God. Like, everyone knows.
Do you know what's terrible about that, Matt?
It's like you're a poker player and you've been losing money for years, and then all of a sudden you realize that, like, for all these years, every time you have aces, you rub your nose. And it's just like, oh my God, I have a tell.
It's so funny, Matt, because he's been using that line with me for, I swear, 5 years now.
Yeah.
If you want to have some fun, Nathan, let's have some fun.
We'll do the same thing. I'm like, oh my God.
It's like when people figured out that they could guilt trip me.
Yeah.
They started telling each other about that.
They could totally do it. Yeah.
Figure out, you know, everybody has weaknesses, you know, and figure out what yours are. You know, maybe that's even more important than figuring out what your opponent's weaknesses are. Is figure out what yours are.
Yeah.
You know, you can't fix them, but you can probably compensate for them.
Well, you can make sure everybody knows them and then just randomly stop doing them, which is very confusing
or
to
just
people.
Stop doing, yeah, that's a good side too. So I've tried to be better about that in recent years, not do quite so many same
Excellent.
Things.
Very good. All right. That's a good note to end on, my friend.
That's positive. That's strong.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me on. Yeah. I hope you guys keep doing these. This is a great idea.
Yeah, I know. It should, as long as we don't make them so long that people, you know, pass away while listening to them. I think it's probably good. Oh, it's not you, it's us. Thanks so much for calling in, Mr. Shields. We will talk to you, I'm sure, when we want to talk about scoring system or something equally geeky.
I will be waiting for that.
Thanks for being on, and thanks to all of you out there for listening to another episode of Diplomacy Cast.
We'll see you next time.